for showing.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is December 8th, 2014, and it is 8 o'clock, and we're going to get started. My colleagues will be trickling in, but we have a very full agenda today, and I want to make sure that everybody gets their turn. So it's very appropriate that I call up first Vicki McConnell and Bill Burns from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, because last time we had to bump them because everything went too long. And they're going to be sharing with us some very important and, I think, exciting information about new technology that is allowing us to get a better sense of what parts of the state are really vulnerable to natural hazards and, in particular, landslide, so that we can have that understanding and take appropriate steps if necessary. So, Vicki, welcome.
Great. Senator Dimbrough and committee members, thank you very much for inviting us back. We do appreciate that. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I have with me Bill Burns, who is our landslide engineering geologist, and we're going to tag team a little presentation for you folks this morning. We're queued up right now, and I just want to make a couple of comments, and then I'm going to turn it over to Bill to kind of go through the nuts and bolts of our landslide hazard mitigation program. So landslide hazard and our mitigation program is mission critical to our agency and is also extremely important to to Oregonians in general. So you had expressed an interest in one part of our landslide hazard program, and that's what we call Slido, which is the statewide layer of information, landslide information layer for the state. So what we're going to do is show you how we get to that information, what it tells us, and how that fits into a landslide hazard mitigation program. And then we'll sum up a little bit about what are some ideas on moving forward with landslide hazard mitigation. So with that, Bill, if you'd introduce yourself and we'll get started.
Sure. Chair Dimbrough, I'm Bill Burns. I'm an engineering geologist with the Oregon Department of Geology and our landslide specialist. And in order to help you understand where our statewide landslide database fits into our process, we have this first figure here that kind of shows this landslide risk reduction process that we've developed. And one of the keys to the process is that we do it in collaboration with the community that's being affected. So whether that be a city or a county, another state agency, or even a federal agency, like a U.S. Forest Service or BLM, the key is really doing that together with them. And from the beginning of this process, the first step in the process is to collect brand new topographic data, very high resolution topographic data called LIDAR data. This LIDAR data allows us to see the surface of the ground. And in Western Oregon, as you can imagine, that's very hard to do. And with a process like a landslide hazard process, which is actually deforming that ground surface, the key is actually getting down and seeing that ground surface. So first is collecting that LIDAR data, then going through and mapping where have all these landslides occurred in the past, using that information to try and predict where they might occur in the future. That's landslide susceptibility. Next is thinking about risk and doing some analysis on risk. So getting a handle on what assets are we concerned about in this area with the landslide hazard. Do we have houses there? Do we have people living there? Do we have infrastructure? Doing some risk analysis and then working with the community to use that information to work on risk reduction. So we thought we'd share with you an example of a project that we finished several years ago. If you remember, in December of 2007, we had a very large storm, very bad flooding in many places in northwest Oregon. One of the cities that was badly flooded and damaged was the city of Vernonia. Along with that flooding, we also had a lot of landslides. In fact, in our database, we have around 1,500 landslides that occurred in this storm. Here's just a couple examples, one in the city of Astoria, and big debris flows that came out and blocked Highway 30. And this is the area right around the city of Vernonia. So the city of Vernonia sits right in here. And the Nehalem River and Highway 47 kind of winding through and going up this way. After the storm, the governor asked our department to help the city understand the flooding hazard and the landslide hazard better. This is the old topographic data. This is the original USGS topographic data. And you can see some of the topography, but it still looks kind of blurry. And this next image is the new LIDAR Bare Earth. And just a very different image. You can see the actual ground surface. And again, the city sits kind of down in here. The Nehalem River coming along here. But the big things that really start to stick out now are areas like this. You can see this very large area over here where the ground surface seems to be undulating. And that's because we've had a big landslide in there, and it's deformed the surface of the earth.
Can I interrupt you just for a sec?
Sure.
Just for the sake of the audience, could you give us a sort of one-minute explanation of what LIDAR is?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. LIDAR data is a new technology. It's a kind of a computer that we hook to an airplane. The airplane is flown back and forth. It shoots these lasers out. The lasers get through the trees and through the vegetation. It's so dense that some of those lasers get down to the surface, the ground surface. And like I said, in Western Oregon, that's very hard to do, very hard to see what the actual ground surface looks like. All these laser beams are then, that information is taken, put into a GIS, a geographical information system, which is kind of a spatial database. And then we make continuous surfaces or digital elevation models from that data. And then that data is used in many different ways. We just use it in this, we're just talking about one way, which is looking at hazards, in this case, flood and landslides.
And Senator Dembro and committee members, and it's really hard to be able to describe that without using words that everyone's going, what's a DEM and a digital elevation map? But really, what it comes down to is, if you think of it, most people have seen topographic maps, topo maps, and you look at that and you interpret what the landforms, what the landscape looks like. And it's only, it's as good of an interpretation as to the resolution. How close are you to what's actually there? Resolution of most topographic maps done by the USGS with the best technology of 19th century is about anything from 10 to 40 feet. So that means when you look at that dot where that is, it could be as much as 40 feet off what the actual elevation is. With these new data that we use with the LIDAR, the accuracy and the precision is down to within a few inches. So what it tells you is really, it's like putting, with me, and you know, it's like putting your glasses on and really being able to see what's there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bob.
So with this new topographic data, we started doing our landslide hazard mapping in this area. When we started out, there was actually, we looked in our statewide landslide database, there was zero landslides mapped in this area. When we finished our mapping, we ended up with a map that looks about like this. We located 630 landslides just in this small little area surrounding the city of Vernonia, which sits down in here. So all these big yellow areas and little red areas are landslides that have occurred in the past. The other thing that we did was, so we have landslides kind of in the hills, but they also have another hazard, flood hazard, down in the valley. And so we used, again, some data along with that new LIDAR topographic data and delineated where the flood hazard zone is, and you can see that in these blue shades around here. the city. The schools were badly flooded and damaged in the event, and they ended up getting moved from down here in the flood zone into kind of a higher zone up here, out of the flood zone, and fortunately not into any of the landslide hazards. So great success. So what we've been talking about so far is landslide inventory, so locating where all these landslides have occurred in the past. Another key to this is using that information, all that data, to try and predict, well, where might we have landslides in the future? And those are susceptibility maps. And so to create a susceptibility map, you need that information. Well, what has happened in the past? You run several models, and out comes susceptibility. Along with susceptibility, like I said, the next step is risk. So just because there's a landslide hazard doesn't mean there's risk. And so we need to consider, well, is there something there that we're concerned about? And in this case, another example, a project that we recently finished in Clackamas County, about a third of the Portland Metro, one of the risk components that we looked at were buildings. And so we used, again, that LIDAR data, such high resolution, we can actually locate where each one of the buildings are. So what you're looking at here is a LIDAR topographic base map in gray, and then each one of these kind of black polygons are buildings. So these are all structures that sit on the ground. We also did the landslide mapping, the inventory mapping, and now I'm going to turn on that inventory. So now you can see these are three large deep-seated landslides. Here's one, here's another one in red, and here's another one, another little piece of one. And now you can see where the hazard is, where the buildings are, and in this case, we attributed the buildings with what type of buildings there are. So what's the use? And in this case, yellow are residential structures, so these are buildings where people are living. Green are public buildings, these are schools, so here's a school, here's another one, and then purple are commercial buildings along Highway 99 right here. Since it's all in GIS, it's all in a database, it's very easy for us to then go in and create some counts. So how many people did we find living on these large deep-seated landslides? And in this case, over 7,000 people in about a third of the metro, living in over 3,000 buildings worth, and we can see how much they're worth.
Thanks, Bill. Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. On these areas that you delineated as landslide areas that have taken place, what's the probability or likeliness that you'll have further landslides there, or are they all played out?
Chair Dembro and Senator Olson, right, that's a great question. And we're still at the point of, like I showed in Vernonia, going from we didn't know where the landslide hazard was to this this kind of jaw-dropping, wow, here's where they all are. There's 630 of them, and here's where they all are. Getting to that next step of likelihood or probability of movement in the future is, you know, the next step for us to figure out. We can do susceptibility, which kind of gives us this relative low, moderate, high likelihood of movement, but actually saying, well, this one might move this much in this many years, not quite there yet with the science.
On your Vernonia statement where you said that there were 630 that they've already been.
Right.
So once again, you need to do more modeling to see which ones are more likely to move and which ones are likely to be stable. And can you figure that out?
Right, Senator Olson. Yes, that is a future step. And, you know, the science isn't really quite there yet. We're still, like I said, we're still at this kind of stage of going, we didn't know almost anything, to at least we know where they all are now. The other big part of that picture is when we can very confidently map where they are, at the same time we're pretty confidently mapping where they're not. And so at least we're kind of splitting the landscape up into you know, here's where they've all happened, and here's where they haven't happened, and hey, they're more likely to happen where they have happened than where they haven't.
And I'd follow up with that, Senator Dembro and Senator Olson and committee members, that observations in the past, particularly with these very large, deep-seated, what they're called ancient to modern landslides, is generally generally, they don't all fail at one time. That whole landscape is vulnerable. So you'll have failures within it that could be triggered by anything from natural occurrences, rivers eroding the toe of it, to building a road along part of it. So we do operate under a general premise that if there's been a landslide there in the past, there's a likelihood that there's a vulnerability to landslides in the future. But being able to nail it down and say this is where it's going to occur, even with our susceptibility modeling and mapping, as Bill said, we're not really there yet.
One more thought. Well, once we get this data collected, will this form exclusionary zones where people can't build anymore because we've determined that there could possibly be a landslide there?
I think that's up to us, Senator.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Dimbro, Senator Olson, and committee members, the maps that we map for the state as the State Geologic Survey are informational and I call it quasi-authoritative, but they do not right now trigger an automatic yes or no or an automatic response. What Bill will be talking about a little bit is right now what we do is we work closely with Department of Land Conservation and Development and with communities to help them understand and determine whether they want to adopt our information into local land use decision making like that in planning.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So want to get back to kind of the reason you asked us to come here today, the statewide landslide information database. And if you remember back in 1996 and 97, we had three very large storms that impacted Oregon. Those storms caused thousands of landslides. In fact, they caused over 9,000 landslides that were recorded in those 2 years. This was a very big wake-up call for us that, you know, landslides were a significant hazard and we needed to start to get a handle on it. And so this was the beginning of that database. We collected information about all these landslides. These landslides caused hundreds of millions of dollars in damage and a lot of fatalities. And since then, we've been continuously kind of upgrading that database. This is the current form of the database. Another thing we did was, besides collecting historic data that's happening in time, we also went into our libraries. You can imagine our department's been there since the 30s, and all the early mapping that was done was on paper maps. So we went into our library, got all those paper maps out, digitized all the locations of the landslides, and put those into our database as well. Ended up with 347 different studies that are kind of put together to make this database. The database right now has over 37,000 landslides located in it and 12,000 historic points, and then it gets continuously updated. So if we create a new map like that Vernonia data, that data gets pushed into the database, and then we update it with a version and then push that information out. Obviously, a very important part, just making a database is great, but actually making that data available is as important. So we have several ways that we get this data out. One is through publications from our department. Another thing we've done is put all this information onto our web in various ways. So, for example, someone can get on there and just download the database if they'd like. Other state agencies and cities and counties use very similar GIS software to us, so we actually stream the data out through our web so they can just stream that data right into their GIS. We also have built an interactive web map viewer that's kind of like a Google map where anyone can just get on there, plug in their address, zoom into their site, and see what kind of information is available at their site. So why is all this important? Well, hopefully I've kind of helped you understand that Oregon's landslide country. And the landslide hazard are a little unique. First, because we're worried about life safety. Next, it's a very chronic hazard. We have landslides every single year in Oregon. And it's a statewide hazard. As I showed you that map, there are landslides that occur statewide. But at the same time, they become a very local hazard when they occur at one single spot. So they're a little tricky. There is no availability of insurance for landslide, which is different than some of the other hazards, right? You can get insurance for flood hazard. You can get insurance for earthquake hazard. You cannot get insurance for landslide hazard. And so what we see over and over is that most people, when a landslide occurs, they tend to lose everything. And one of the biggest investments we all make in our lives are usually a home, and then losing all that is just devastating. We also get very little help from the federal government. So, for example, the flood hazard, we have this national insurance, and so FEMA needs to keep that flood data up to date, and so they feed funding into that to keep that kind of engine going. Right now, one of the main ways that we've been getting funding to work on landslide hazards is after disasters. So we have a disaster like that storm in 2007. Some funding becomes available, and we write a proposal to get some of that funding to work on that landslide hazard in that area that was affected. And this really isn't the ideal way to get ahead of the hazard, to just wait for disasters to happen and hope that we get some funding to work on it. You know, an ideal way would be to have a permanent program where we can get in front of this thing. And finally, just a reminder of why, if I haven't convinced you yet, we had this very devastating landslide that occurred just north of here in Washington State at the beginning of this year, the Oso landslide. And this is what it looks like. The Still Guamish River comes through here, so the landslide went across the river, and the community used to be under this part of the landslide. And we can turn on this image so that you can see where all the houses and infrastructure used to be. All these black dots are where the buildings used to be and where the highway used to be. Just a devastating event that really reminds us to keep working on this hazard, keep trying to get in front of it. And finally, just this is what our statewide landslide information database looks like right now. And again, it really looks like we've been doing a great job. You can see kind of all the areas that we've delineated across the state. And yeah, we have been working very hard at it. But at the same time, unfortunately, the areas that we've actually finished and gone through this, most of this, or all of that process that I showed you at the beginning, the risk reduction process, are these areas in dark green. So portions of the Portland Metro. Here's the Vernonia area I was talking about, along Highway 30, City of Astoria, a couple little watersheds in the Cascades and the Coast Range, and then a small area down on the coast there. So we still have a long ways to go. That was all I had.
Right, and so I just want to stress, to sum this up quickly, and that's precisely where we stand right now. This program, although again it is mission critical, it is one of our part of our strategic plan, but it is basically an ad hoc program, meaning again, as Bill said, we respond to when a community or a county or a disaster or ODOT occurs, and then we help them wrap their arms around what has already happened so they can think about the future. We do not have a comprehensive landslide hazard mitigation program in the state. Excuse me. We did put that in our agency request budget, and the governor's recommended budget does have an identification of appropriating some funds toward doing precisely that, actually getting what would a comprehensive program look like, how would we prioritize, how would we go about methodically looking at landslide hazards in the state. And so now we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, both of you. This, you know, I know this is going to be a topic we're going to be addressing in the next session, and so it's good to have this as a sort of preview, and also just to give us a sense of the technology right now. But it sounds, I mean, just looking at that last map, that there's a lot of work to be done. And so I expect it'll be discussed here in this committee and also in the Ways and Means subcommittee. Colleagues, any further questions? I do have one, and that is, you know, as you're kind of looking forward, one of the things we're hearing a lot about is with, you know, is the impact of global warming on creating conditions that can create more landslides. So is that something that, you know, that you intend to include in this comprehensive mapping program?
Senator Bimbrough and committee members, yes. And that really goes back to a few years ago when Department of Land Conservation and Development had led a group of agencies to put together for the state a framework for climate change adaptation. And in that was an identification of how do we understand and model toward changes in hazards that would the impact of hazards based on a change in our climate. And one of the things that one of the identifications is what appears to be in the models would be that we would continue to have a lot of precipitation on the west side, but perhaps it won't be as much in snowpack, and it'll be earlier where we would have a lot more rainfall precipitation instead of snow. And rainfall, and the amount of rainfall, is one of the direct causes of landslide hazards in hilly and mountainous areas. So even though I can't quantify that, at least if you're looking at that from the empirical point, is we could expect to have more activity with slope failures based on that type of a climate change.
Thank you. Well, thank you both very much for coming.
Very
right
welcome.
On schedule. Another solid presentation from geology. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm going to call up our next topic then, and this is about the state's response to the new EPA in-process rulemaking with respect to power plant emissions. So we have Dick Peterson from DEQ, Colin McConaughey from DEQ, Andy Ginsberg from Department of Energy, and Jason Eisdorfer. If you can all fit. That's great, from the PUC. Okay, Dick, why don't you introduce yourself?
We'll get started here, and we can catch up with the slides, Chair Dembrough. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dick Peterson. I'm director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality, and thanks for your interest in learning about the EPA's proposed Clean Power Plan, which we're here to talk with you about today. What the Clean Power Plan does, it proposes to seek carbon dioxide emission reductions from existing coal and natural gas power plants. With me here today to explain this proposal that EPA has and how it might work for Oregon is Colin McConaughey with the EQ, Andy Ginsberg with the Oregon Department of Energy, and Jason Eisdorfer with the Public Utilities Commission. Okay, we're caught up. EPA's Clean Power Plan is one of the most significant efforts under the Obama administration to reduce the country's domestic greenhouse gas emissions. Lowering greenhouse gas emissions in the power sector is a key step under the president's Climate Action Plan. And what this proposal does is it would lower CO2 emissions from power plants by 30% from 2005 levels by 2030. EPA is authorized to do this under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. That's what they're proposing this regulation. That's why it's referred to as 111D. So a little bit on the timeline here is that this rule was proposed in June of this year, and comments were due to EPA by December 1st of this year. Oregon did submit comments by that deadline. The final rule, as we hear it from EPA, is expected to come out in June of 2015. Now, as it's proposed, what the states would be required to do is put together compliance plans by June of 2016. We could get an extension if we work forward with other states to come up with a compliance stand that's either bi-state or multi-state, but that's yet to be determined. I'm not going to go through this other than to say we've done a lot of coordination. Very pleased to report that we've been coordinating with our other state agencies here and also with multiple stakeholders within the state and outside of the states, as this rule is complex and it affects a lot of folks. And so we worked hard to do a lot of coordinating with others. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Colin, and then he'll take it from here.
And let me just say, Colin, before you get started, for the members of the audience and people who might be watching this online, this PowerPoint, as well as the other PowerPoints, are all available online under the section Meeting Materials, so you can look at them after the fact, or those of you who are here can watch the screen. Thank you.
Great. In OLIS.
In OLIS, yeah.
Whatever. Thanks, Dick. For the record, my name is Colin McConaughey with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm going to briefly introduce the process that EPA expects for their proposed Clean Power Plan. How the Clean Power Plan and really any rule issued under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act works, first, is EPA initially sets a national emission reduction guideline, and that guideline is based on the best system of emission reductions, which includes, according to, Section 111D of the Clean Air Act, this guideline includes all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce the particular pollutant from the targeted facility types. So, of course, in this case, that would be all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce CO2 emissions from existing coal and natural gas power plants. Once EPA has determined all these adequately demonstrated measures and developed their national emission reduction guideline, they then apply that guideline to each state. And because the power sector characteristics differ by each state, although the guideline is uniform, it produces distinct state emission reduction goals. So after they have applied the guideline to each state and provided states with their emission reduction obligations, states then are given broad flexibility to develop a state implementation plan that in which they determine the most cost-effective or otherwise preferred measures that they would like to pursue as a state to achieve their emission reduction obligations. Once states have developed these plans, they then submit them for review and approval by EPA. And in the case of this plan, EPA expects that states' plans, as Dick just mentioned, will be due by 2016 or with an extension in 2017 or 18, and the compliance would begin in 2020. And states will be, again, under this anticipated schedule from EPA, states would be achieving their total emission reduction obligations by 2030. Before I get any further into these, what EPA has proposed specifically in their Clean Power Plan, I want to briefly mention a real important point here for this particular rule, and that is going back to that term I mentioned that comes from Section 111D, the best system of emission reductions, which is what the federal emission guideline is to be based on. In this case, the word system and how EPA interprets that word has real significant influence on the overall reductions that they're able to require of states. Because it's dealing with the power sectors, the word system could be interpreted a few different ways. And the most narrow definition of system in this case would look just at the emission reductions that could be achieved within the power plants themselves. So what measures could be taken at the natural gas or coal-fired facilities themselves to make them operate more efficiently and produce less CO2 emissions per unit of generation. A broader interpretation of the word system would acknowledge the interconnectedness of these power plants across the transmission grid to incorporate additional emission reductions that could be achieved by shifting generation away from coal and onto the existing natural gas plants. Natural gas is about emits about half as much CO2 as coal. And finally, a broader interpretation still of system would acknowledge the broader power sector and include additional emission reductions that could be achieved from renewable energy and end-use energy efficiency. So getting into now what EPA has proposed specifically in their Clean Power Plan, they did interpret the word system broadly to include not just what can be done at the power plants, but also shifting generation away from coal and including renewables and energy efficiency. And they've broken up their emission guideline into four building blocks, as they refer to them. And these blocks correspond roughly with the concentric circles in the preceding slide. The first block, which includes emission reductions from improving the operations of coal plants. The second block in their emission guideline includes additional emission reductions from shifting away from coal and onto natural gas. And block three of their emission guideline includes emission reductions that can be achieved by investing further in renewable energy. And then finally, the fourth building block includes additional emission reductions that can be achieved by lowering our overall energy demand on power plants through end-use energy efficiency. And EPA's guideline works such that it adds up the emission reductions that can be achieved by each of these blocks, adds them up together when they're applied to each state, and it produces states' emission reduction obligations in the form of an emission rate, which is expressed in pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour of generation. For Oregon, when EPA applies this emission guideline, they applied it using to states using the most recent data that was available to them at the time, which was national data for 2012 on states' emissions and generation characteristics in the power sector for each state. And in Oregon in 2012, from that data, our average emission rate was 717 pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour generated here in Oregon. And when EPA applies those four building blocks to Oregon, it produces a 48% reduction, going down from 717 pounds to 372 pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour. Just want to briefly mention these four building blocks, really the latter three, correspond to some efforts that are already in place here in Oregon. As you may know, we already have an agreement with Portland General Electric to cease coal operations at Boardman, which is our only coal-fired power plant here in the state. That agreement is in place for those operations to cease in 2020. So that corresponds roughly with building block two. And then we also have, as you may know, a renewable portfolio standard, which encourages or requires the further development of renewable energy to serve Oregon customers. And we also have significant energy efficiency investments. Oregon's one of the national leaders in energy efficiency, and that's in large part due to the significant investments made by the Energy Trust of Oregon and by the Bonneville Power Administration. I'm going to transition now to describe some of the comments that state agencies provided EPA recently in our comment letter. We developed this letter jointly with the Department of Energy and the Public Utility Commission. And the letters provide strong support for the rule in general, for it producing a national greenhouse gas policy for the power sector, and more specifically support for EPA defining the system broadly, as I mentioned earlier, so that the proposal can require more meaningful emission reductions. However, most of the letter is devoted to making recommendations for EPA to make changes or clarification in their final rule. And for that, I'm going to hand it over to Andy to describe some of the more significant recommendations we made.
Thanks, Colin. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg with the Oregon Department of Energy. And before I jump into our comments, I just wanted to discuss briefly two really important characteristics of the power system in the Northwest that are somewhat different than other parts of the country and that really drove a lot of our comments. And the first characteristic is that Oregon's electric load is served, about a third of our load is served by hydropower from the Bonneville Power Administration. So this map shows, it's a little bit busy, but this map shows the electric utility service territories in Oregon. And the hashed areas are investor-owned utilities like Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp. And the solid colors are consumer-owned utilities. So most of the power that's provided by Oregon's consumer-owned utilities is zero-carbon hydropower that comes from the Bonneville Power Administration. But in setting the emission reduction goal for Oregon, EPA looked at all of the state. They considered not only the power generated by our investor-owned utilities, but also the power that's provided by consumer-owned utilities, including that zero-carbon hydropower. So, and this is because when you lower demand at the consumer-owned utilities, that allows BPA's hydropower to be used somewhere else on the system, and that would ultimately back off fossil power generation, although that would occur primarily in other states. So because EPA set our goal considering all parts of the state, it's critical that we get to use emission reductions that occur in all parts of our state in our compliance plan. So that drove one of our comments. The second important characteristic about the power system that I want to mention is that although we're a net exporter of power overall, we're a net importer of fossil-generated power. So this map shows the power that serves Oregon and includes hydropower system that's shown in light blue, and coal plants shown in gray, natural gas plants in orange, and windmills in dark blue, and then there's some other sources there as well. And so the important thing to note here is the number of fossil fuel power plants that we rely on that are located in other states, such as Utah, Wyoming, and Montana. We also export and import a fair amount of renewable energy. And so because of the interconnected nature of the power system, it's really important that we get credit for actions that we take to reduce emissions, not only in Oregon, but when those emission reductions occur in other states. And also, it's important to note that it's not always possible to tell exactly where the emission reductions will occur due to this interconnected nature of the power system. So turning to our comments on Block 3, or renewable power, EPA's proposal for using renewable energy in state compliance plans does, in fact, recognize the interconnected nature of the power system. So by and large, we supported the approach that EPA took here. Although, of course, we had some specific recommendations on some of the details. So basically, EPA has proposed that states can take credit for emission reductions that come from renewable energy that serves our load, regardless of what state the renewable power is generated in. We supported this approach because it would ensure that the ratepayers who fund the investment in renewable energy get the benefit from those investments. Also, it continues to create incentives for policies that we may develop to expand the use of renewable energy, such as the renewable portfolio standard that Colin mentioned. And last, because it would allow us to use our existing tracking system, which is the Western Renewable Energy Generation Information System, or REGIS, to keep track of compliance with 111D. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jason, who will talk about our comments on Block 4, as well as some cross-cutting issues.
Thanks, Andy. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer with the Public Utility Commission. excuse me. Without question, energy efficiency is the most cost-effective tool we can use to comply with the emission reduction goals in the proposed rule. Because Oregon is very, very good at energy efficiency through the Energy Trust of Oregon for PGE and Pacific Corp customers, and the Bonneville Power Administration program for the publicly owned utilities, we looked very closely at EPA's treatment of energy efficiency in the rule. Unfortunately, EPA's primary approach for energy efficiency compliance requires states to track back, that's their language, energy efficiency to in-state fossil fuel generation. That means we need to connect our energy efficiency savings to emission reductions of in-state fossil fuel generation. And because Oregon imports so much of our fossil fuel generation, this means at the end of the day that Oregon can only use a small amount of the energy efficiency we do or could acquire in the state, as little as 12% under some circumstances for compliance. So arguably, this is the most important recommendation that we had in the state letter. That we recommend that the EPA allow the state that invests in energy efficiency to receive credit for the full value of those emission reductions. I should say that because Oregon's letter came out before most other letters, we are understanding both from EPA and other parties that EPA hears us loud and clear. We don't know what they're going to do yet on this, but they know this is an issue. Similarly, we took a look at other energy efficiency issues with an eye toward making sure the state gets full credit toward compliance. We looked at codes and standards and market transformation. Codes and standards in Oregon that are better than federal codes should get energy efficiency credit, while those codes are better than federal codes. And likewise, market transformation, those activities undertaken and financed by the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance that brings efficient technologies to market faster and cheaper than they otherwise would get to market should also receive energy efficiency credit. It is unclear at this point whether EPA is allowing those measures to count toward compliance. It's also not clear whether the substantial energy efficiency investments in publicly owned territories, which receive power from the fossil fuel-free federal hydro system, will count toward compliance. As Andy said, because the federal system is interconnected with fossil fuel generation, a megawatt hour of energy efficiency tends to lead toward a reduction in fossil fuel emissions elsewhere. This energy efficiency also should count toward compliance. Multi-state agreements. EPA has been very supportive in the proposed rule of multi-state agreements. These hold the possibility of more efficient and less expensive compliance. But EPA was clearly thinking of agreements like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. This is a program in the Northeast where several participating states will actually pool or join their individual state emission reduction goals into one. We think there are other forms of multi-state agreements short of blending state targets that can utilize least cost compliance across state borders. For example, if Oregon produces an abundance of cost-effective energy efficiency, a multi-state agreement would allow Oregon to trade energy efficiency credits to Wyoming, for example, to meet their own goal. And that would be a benefit ultimately to both states. So we recommend that the EPA clarify that there is flexibility in the forms of multi-state agreements.
Thank you, Jason. We've had lots of dialogue with EPA. These are really important points to Oregon that have been raised, and we will continue to do so as to the extent we can. They've ended their comment period, so they have to limit their conversation because of that. But if we stay on point in terms of what we already submitted, we'll continue to have that dialogue with EPA. It's really important for Oregon that we continue this multi-state agency coordination, which is a great benefit because it crosses all those sectors. And I think we've all benefited in getting our comments to EPA that reflect what Oregon's state agencies' needs and responsibilities are. We will continue to outreach with stakeholders on compliance options, because when EPA does issue their final rule in, as expected, in June of 2015, the state will have to develop a compliance path to achieve those. And we need to continue to work with all of our stakeholders and others and what that compliance path would mean. And we will develop that plan with input from stakeholders. That's been very important to get our comments to EPA, and we'll continue that once EPA does issue its final rule. Because it's under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act, and it is delegated to the responsibility of DEQ to implement, it will likely cause us to ask the EQC Environmental Quality Commission to make rule change to reflect what's required there. So we'll have to do that. And we don't know at this point, because we haven't seen the final rule, it may take legislative action. We just don't know at this point in time. But not knowing that doesn't mean that our commitment to you, Chair Dembro, and this committee, if whatever you would like and us to keep you up to speed on what's going on, what we're doing, we're happy to do that, or rest of the legislative body, because we see this will be an important activity that the state embarks on, and your involvement is critically important. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. And so just to clarify, you don't foresee us having to take any legislative action in the next session in 2015, since we won't be getting back the EPA proposed rules until the summer.
Yeah, Chair Dembro, that's correct. We wouldn't know what to do, because we won't see the final rule until at least then. Yeah.
Great. Colleagues, questions? Yes.
I've got Senator Hensel. Two or three, if I may.
Well, let's hear them, and then I'll decide.
Had the privilege of being at a conference in Washington, D.C. on energy not too long ago, and 111D was presented, and frankly, it's really scary. There's a lot of states that just are very concerned about what it is. I appreciate very much knowing the different questions and statements that we have put forward, because that would certainly help clarify it. I guess my basic question is, do you believe that if EPA does not take into consideration any of what we've done, any or all, that we can realistically meet a 48% reduction? especially when, what was the cutoff date? Anything before that doesn't count, I understand. So what was the date that was set? I forget what it is.
The
2012? That we only have moving forward from that.
Yes, that Chair Dembro, Senator Hansel, that is correct. Yep.
So nothing that we've done before 2012 counts, is what I understand. But although we're trying to make that happen.
Yeah, Chair Dembro, Senator Hansel, and perhaps one of my colleagues can answer it better, but one of our concerns that we've raised is that they've created what they call a baseline year of 2012. And we've raised a concern about that because 2012 was a big hydro year. And so from our perspective, it would not be what we would call an average. So if we get into an average hydro year, we'd almost be penalized for generating more power during a big power year. So that's one of the comments we've made, and we've had a lot of dialogue with EPA about the importance of that, and they seem to be listening.
Do you think we can get 48% without them taking into consideration these questions that you've had?
Yeah, Senator Dembro, Senator Hansel, I think it might be difficult for us if they don't address the comments that we've made.
One last question. Do you think the change in Congress will have an effect on the President's executive order dealing with 111D?
Chair Dembro, Senator Hansel, I don't feel like I'm in a place where I could speculate what that might be.
Fair enough.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
I was also fortunate enough to be back to D.C. to talk about 111D. And one of the conversations that we had was that those generating facilities for PGE and PacifiCorp, which generate predominantly outside of the state, will not count for our reduction. It will only count statewide. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can get around that is to go into a bi-state deal. Is that going to be our goal? Because predominantly, we don't have a lot of natural gas generation or coal generation in our state, do we?
Senator Dembro, Senator Olson, that is true. With Boardman coal fire plant shutting down, we will have zero coal fire generation within our state. The way EPA has structured their proposed rule is to really look within borders of the state and look at what is available and what can be reduced. Unfortunately, the way we read the proposed rule is that if there is energy efficiency, for instance, that we apply within the state, we don't get credit for it because it'll go to where we get our coal-fired plant might be generating electricity. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we don't get penalized for the work that we're doing in Oregon. And we're still wondering about how we would approach a bi-state or a multi-state agreement. We're not close to that, but every state, quite honestly, is trying to figure it out within their own borders, and there's been some conversation, dialogue about how states might band together, but we have a ways to go there.
Follow-up.
Hold it just a sec. Jason, maybe you could weigh in.
Chair Dembro, I just wanted to mention that as part of our multi-agency activities, we've modeled several different kinds of outcomes, and it really will depend on what the final rule looks like. Oregon will be able to take credit, for example, for Boardman closing down. Our renewable portfolio standard will help a lot. Our energy efficiency will help a lot. So if EPA addresses our concerns, there is a path to get where we need to go. If EPA doesn't address our concerns, it becomes much more difficult.
This is just a question we discussed back there, and it was rather interesting, and I want to see if you guys have seen this. The states with larger CO2 output have a less percentage of reduction. We, as a very efficient state, have a very large, matter of fact, ours is larger than Washington. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that? Have you seen the numbers?
And maybe you could explain why that is. The methodology.
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, I'll get us started and others can try to answer the question. Yes, every state has, I've seen all of the percent reductions from all of the other states that are expected. Ours is one of the largest. In terms of percentage, So if you go to a state that generates a lot of electricity or has a lot of coal-fired plants, their percentage may be less, but their CO2 output is much greater. So if you look at it purely from a percentage perspective, their expected reduction in CO2 emission is a lot, could be a lot larger. So you have to think about not only percentages, but how much within that state is being emitted in terms of CO2. So that's kind of the basis by which EPA looked at each state. So percentages are one thing, total output is another, and you have to look at all of that to make sure the percentage is relevant to output as well.
One final question.
Yeah. Well, let's.
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, I'll just add that EPA, as Colin described, EPA came up with the targets for each state based on looking at each of the four blocks in each state. So the reduction goal is based on really what the potential EPA sees in each of the four blocks in each state. And so they really didn't calculate a percentage on the front end. That's a result of what they came up with. It's a step-by-step. So theoretically, even though states have different percentage goals, and as Dick said, they, you know, the states with lower percentage goal may actually be expected to achieve more tons of reduction. But the idea is it's basically a roughly equal challenge for each state based on what their potential is.
Yeah, and so just to clarify that, we've done a lot of things here in this state. We've fought a lot of hard political battles, you know, to move us in a certain direction that should make it easier for us to meet these goals relative to a number of other states. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Chair Dembro, that's very true, and I think as Jason pointed out, if EPA looks at our comments and reacts to them favorably, we do have a pretty straightforward compliance plan for meeting those.
And final question. While you're doing these reports, are you looking at the economics? Is anybody studying what it's going to cost us?
Mr. Eisdorfer.
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, sort of yes and no. Until we get the final rule and ultimately DEQ begins to figure out what that implementation plan, I think that's where the rubber will meet the road. In our modeling, we have looked at how we could meet comply going forward, and it relies a lot on existing policies. So in that regard, as Chair Dembro said, because of the policies we have in this state, it might be a little bit of a stretch, but we really have the groundwork in the state, and so in that regard, cost wouldn't be the biggest factor. Again, if EPA sort of goes in a different direction and we have to look at a different set of compliance tools, then I think we have to be very concerned about the costs.
And I would add that that's certainly on a micro scale for Oregon. I know EPA did look at benefits from the rule in terms of cost, and I don't have the detail of that, so we can certainly see what's been out there and provide it if you're interested.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Really appreciate this presentation, and I look forward to hearing more about these creative partnerships and things as they develop. Colleagues, we are slightly ahead of schedule.
Coffee right. Time.
So it's time to open our next item, which is another report on our investigation of pesticide spraying and incident reporting, and how Oregon does things versus our state to the north. And to that end, we are going to be hearing from a couple of people from the Washington Department of Health. And they're phoning in.
Chair Dembro and committee, I believe Wayne Clifford and Joel Kansinger. Wayne Clifford's from the Department of Health and Joel Kansinger's from the Department of Agriculture. Are you both on the line?
Yes, this is Joel. Yes.
Okay. Gentlemen, welcome. We really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about the way that pesticide use is monitored and incidents are responded to up in Washington. Before we start that, though, I do want to welcome our good colleague, Representative McEwen from the South Coast is here with us. And I think we may have some students here in the room. Is that right? Do we have? There were some students who were going to be here. They may be out in the hall watching TV. Okay, gentlemen, we're all ears.
Manager for the pesticide surveillance program here in the Washington State Department of Health, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about our program. And I guess I jumped in, so I'll go first. Joel?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So the program is kind of... Well, so the difference between the Department of Health and like the Department of Agriculture, and the reason Joel's here is because we're not a compliance program. We're a public health surveillance program, and so there's some differences in that. And so a couple of the goals of our program are, number one, we work on determining the likelihood of an illness, a reported illness being associated with a pesticide. That's one of the primary things we do. And the second thing we do is try and take collect pretty in-depth data to then do analysis and turn that into some sort of public health prevention for the future to reduce human illness. So the bulk of what we do is focused on data collection, analysis, and interpretation, and we're not a first responder organization. We're a surveillance organization. And so I thought I'd maybe just walk through our investigation process because there's a number of components, and the other thing that I hope you'll appreciate is that. Our process is not a line, a bright line like it is in compliance, where they're looking to see was the law violated or not. We have levels of evidence that lead us to be more confident that the illness itself is associated with the pesticide. It usually starts with a notification of an event, and we say a pesticide event is the release of a pesticide, so it could be an aerial application or somebody putting Roundup on their patio or something. So that's an event. A few sources, we work closely with the Department of Agriculture and their investigators. We also are connected to our poison center, and we mine data from them electronically. It's also our Department of Labor and Industries. And so we go through a process of screening those initial complaints or whatever they are and determine whether or not they meet our criteria to further the investigation. So once it's confirmed that we're going to investigate, then the first thing we want to do is contact the workers or bystanders or the people who are reporting the illnesses and get those, because we interview them and we want to get those interviews done as soon as possible because we have such a large farm worker population here and their migrant farm workers tend to move on fairly quickly. So sometimes it's pretty hard to get those. If there's any delay, sometimes it's hard to track them down. But we want to get those interviews done, get the investigation initiated within 48 hours of notification. We interview witnesses, people who saw the incident. And from the patient's information, we if if they have sought medical care, will review the medical records to see what was determined by the physician. And this is areas that we have authority to review people's medical records related to these incidents with or without their consent. So we, as the Department of Health, we go directly to the healthcare provider and we can request those records. Although we always inform the people that we'll be looking at them.
Mr. Clifford?
And this is one of the big differences between us and Department of Agriculture, that's statutory authority. So then another step is to review the pesticide application record, and we usually get those application records through the Department of Agriculture or Labor and Industries. And it is a requirement of the applicator, if we request those records, it is a requirement that the applicator provide them to us on request. And we will, we can also interview the applicator to find out, you know, what's their side of it, and what do they know something went wrong, or do they think they were doing everything correctly. And all of this is done when there's a compliance investigation going on at the same time. All this is done in collaboration with the compliance agency. And one of the other pieces of information that we'll review is it often our Department of Agriculture will collect environmental samples or clothing samples and have them tested at their lab. And so we'll want to review that data. That's usually pretty valuable because if you can detect the pesticide that was implicated in the illness, if you can detect it on the worker's clothing or something like that, or the people's clothing or adjacent materials around them, that starts drawing a stronger connection to the event, the illness. And all this leads us to classify the individual case. And cases, again, are people. So each case from an event will be classified, and we have there's a kind of a list of classifications that are we consider to be confirmed illnesses, and then the rest of them fall out as there's a category system that we follow is followed nationally by other states, and I think Oregon follows this too, is that it falls into either being a suspicious, unlikely, insufficient information, or not a case. And there is a case coding matrix that we follow that provides consistency in those classifications, and there is also room for a judgment in the investigator if they feel that this particular case doesn't necessarily fit the matrix, that they can override that. And that is built into a data system that they all enter these cases into. And then, like I said, one of the major goals that we try to do, we've done this a number of times, and researchers have used the data, is to try to understand not necessarily just the number of people that were exposed, and isn't that a bad thing? It's why were they exposed? We know that there's pesticides being applied with people around, and if everything is done correctly, there should be no exposure to illnesses. And so what we want to know is why, and is there something else that can be done in the future? So our data often feeds back into training and other prevention activities, changing pesticide labels if the label's not protective enough, or maybe entry intervals were looked at, and those types of things. So that's a real brief summary, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions you have.
Uh,
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Clifford. I'm sure we will have some questions, but why don't we hear some follow-up from Mr. Kangeser first?
Yes, good morning. I'm Joel Kangeser, and I'm the Pesticide Compliance Program Manager for the Department of Agriculture here in Washington. And I guess just to start out, I'll say that the Department of Agriculture up here in Washington is the state lead agency for the enforcement of FIFRA, and that's the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act, and that's administered by EPA. And just as Oregon is the state lead agency in Oregon, we also have state laws and rules, and just as Oregon does, our division, the Pesticide Management Division, has four programs. We have a certification and training program, registration program, dairy waste management program, and then my program, the pesticide compliance program. So the role of our compliance program is to enforce the laws and rules for pesticide use and distribution. And we really try to stay focused on that. There are a lot of times there are people that have issues with pesticides. They may not like the fact that their neighbor is applying a pesticide or that certain pesticide applications are going on, that type of thing. But if we don't, you know, if they call us and we don't really can't see that a violation is occurring, we can't really afford to get involved with those issues because they can become very time-consuming. And in the end, they're kind of beyond our role and our jurisdiction. So we try to upfront screen a lot of our calls. We get a lot of calls that we aren't able to respond to. As far as investigation, our work is really composed of either doing investigations, like when we get a complaint, or we can go out and we will do inspections of commercial applicators, pesticide dealers, those type of things. So those are kind of our two primary focus areas. And then, of course, we do technical assistance and make presentations during the winter when there's not many pesticide applications going on. The investigations, we do probably roughly around 150 per year. And, you know, not all of those are the result of a complaint. Some of those could be where our investigator is out in the field and he sees something occurring. Well, the investigator can initiate an investigation on that in that type of situation without getting a complaint. So those type of things happen. But I would say probably a good portion, maybe, you know, rough guess would be 75% of our investigations are the result of a complaint that we get. Typically on an investigation, there's some basic things that we do, and each complaint call or investigation is kind of unique to the circumstances. But there's some basic things we would do. Of course, we would inspect the incident site and, you know, neighboring properties, that type of thing, especially if it's a drift complaint. We want to see if there, there are any visual symptoms of drift. Sometimes you can, you know, if it's an herbicide, obviously, you're looking for plant damage symptoms, those type of things, and we would want to visually verify that, yes, it looks like just off of the target site, the symptoms are really bad, and as you get further away from the target site, those symptoms lessen as you go along. So that would be kind of a visual indication that a drift occurred, and that drift was the result of the application to the particular target site. Normally, we pull samples when we're out there. We don't always. I would say that majority of the time we would take samples and have them analyzed for the residues for whatever the applicator was applying. There can be circumstances where we do not pull samples. Either the samples, for example, a human exposure case, sometimes we get called in after the fact, a substantial amount of time, and like for clothing from the person that may have been exposed, if that clothing is unavailable or it's been washed or that type of thing, where we determine that we would not pick up any residues with analysis, we may forego taking those type of samples. There are also certain chemistries that happen to break down very rapidly in the environment, and if the call to us gets delayed, which it sometimes will, we'll make a determination that, you know, whether or not we're apt to pick up residues when we do the sampling. But it, with that said, I think most of the time we would pull samples. We will also request records from the applicator at the target site, and we'll also look at likely request records from other, you know, if it's a heavy agricultural situation where you've got field after field of agricultural crops, we will also request records from the applicators in the area just to verify that, you know, maybe one of the other applicators was using the same product and, you know, be able to justify defend our sampling and the analysis that comes out of the samples that we take. So we pull records, or when I say we pull records, we submit a record request, and they're required by law to submit those records to us. We will also take testimony from the witnesses, both the complainant and the applicator, and then other witnesses that may be involved. We review product labels. There are times we will examine the application equipment. We don't always do that, but there are circumstances where we do that. We normally review weather data on a drift complaint. We'll take a look. We have ag weather stations usually within a couple miles. You know, sometimes they can be out to 5 or 6 miles away. That weather data, the further away, of course, that it is from the incident location, the less bearing that would have on our investigation. So we look at all those things. We'll also look at any other source of information that's available to us that could have a bearing on the case. Human exposure cases, out of those 150 investigations we do, you know, I'm just going to say roughly 25 maybe to 30% of those have something to do with human exposure, and that's not always a drift situation or an overspray situation. There can be other situations where say a pest control operator makes an application to a home and someone becomes ill from that situation. That might be something we would get involved with. It'd be what we would consider a human exposure case, and yet it doesn't involve drift or overspray. The rules require us to respond immediately to any human exposure complaint, and we consider that as the same day is immediate, and we've been very successful in responding. It's like 96 or 97% of all of our responses, and that includes non-human exposure. Non-human exposure cases. Very high percent where we do respond actually at the same day. We're usually on site that same day also when we have a human exposure case. Occasionally it can be the following day, but we always make contact with at least the complainant that first day. If we can't get out to the site that same day, it's usually the next day. For human exposure cases, again, we almost always will take samples. If the clothing of the person that was alleged to be exposed, if that is available, we try to get that as one of our samples. Sometimes the clothing is destroyed during the sample analysis, so occasionally you'll get a person that doesn't want to give away their clothing. There can be other situations, again, that I mentioned earlier, where someone has washed their clothing, and we pretty much know that we won't get any hits when we have that analyzed. So we would forgo taking clothing samples there. The you know, there can be situations where we'll get a complaint and we kind of analyze what's going on. We'll ask a lot of questions, and sometimes we can't really determine that a actual violation of the pesticide laws or rules are involved. And so we may decide not to respond or go out on site, I should say, to those particular calls. We just have to, you know, really prioritize our resources. So there are those situations. And again, especially within this last year, we've been trying to screen the calls that we go out on and make sure that when we do go out, it's our role, and if we have jurisdiction, the number of field incident site visits that we've done within this last year has gone down somewhat because we are doing a little more screening, and return for that, we're trying to do more inspections of, like, for example, commercial applicators and dealers and farmers who are licensed with us. Let's see here. Our penalty authority, by law, we're required to write a notice of correction on a first-time violation unless the violation involves potential human injury or harm, or if it involves plant damage or property damage over $1,000, or if the violation would involve more than minor environmental harm. So those three types of incidents, we can actually go to a civil penalty and or license suspension for a first-time event. All other violations, we would write a notice of correction. And then if they repeat the violation and it happens again in the future, then we would go directly to a civil penalty on that. We probably issue between 25 and 30 notices of intent, which basically are charging papers for taking a or issuing a penalty. So out of all the cases that we do and all the inspections, only roughly 25 to 30 of those end up with a civil penalty and or a license suspension. I think that is, I don't have anything else written down, but I'd be happy to try to answer any of your questions at this point.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kengeiser. That was very, very informative. I do have a question just about the relationship between the two agencies. And so, Mr. Clifford, this would involve you as well. You know, the processes that you've been talking about, it sounds as if they're happening potentially in parallel. And do you ever bump up against each other or, you know, are things sometimes overly duplicative, or what is the relationship like? Perhaps you could say more about that.
Wayne, do you want to talk first, or?
Sure. So I think we have a really close relationship with the Department of Agriculture, and often I get a call from my one of my investigators saying, "Hey, Ag just called me, and there's an event, and we're meeting up and heading out." And they'll actually do a joint investigation, and we'll help with the interview of the people, and they kind of divide up some of the work. So what I see is the relationships between the investigators on the ground, and then also Joel and I as peers overseeing the programs. You know, we communicate frequently about, you know, do we see any bumps happening? You know, what do we need to do, and work at the management level to help everybody be successful out there.
And I would just add, this is Joel. I would just add, we do have a memorandum of understanding between the two agencies, and one of the things that we do if we. When we're out there investigating a complaint, if they have, or even when we get the initial call, if someone is saying that they were exposed to a pesticide, they have symptoms, they don't, you know, whatever those might be. It's in the memorandum of understanding that we will contact Department of Health. So that's one of the first things, primary things that we would do on any of these incidents.
Colleagues, any questions? I do have one. As you're going through your investigation of a complaint, what is your relationship with the public at that point? I mean, if there is a suspicion of a misapplication that could, you know, or a drift that could harm a number of people, are people in the area notified that, you know, if they're experiencing certain symptoms, that something may have happened? Just, you know, in general, what is the relationship between your agencies and the public when such a thing happens?
This is Joel. Normally, anyone that would potentially be affected by that drift incident is already very aware of, you know, the situation. There could be residues in there. I mean, by the time we get out there, there's been a lot of communication with the parties, and we would normally not be out notifying the public unless if there was a potential there that someone else could be exposed or injured or something like that. Certainly we would, you know, we would get involved in something like that. But the incidents that we look at, for example, on a drift case, we would, you know, you're talking about one agricultural field over onto a residence, or one agricultural field over onto a neighboring agricultural field. So almost always, I would say that all the potential people that would be exposed are already aware of the situation. We don't get the media involved or the public involved unless it's something pretty unusual. Earlier this spring, in April and early May, we kind of had this a whole bunch of drift incidents that occurred within just a few weeks' time. It was something that was kind of unusual, a high number of drift cases. The weather played a factor, and there were a number of other things that went on there. In that case, actually, Department of Health and Department of Agriculture kind of worked together, and we each put out a news release about the situation. And you know, our part was, Department of Ag, was that we were just reminding applicators they need to be careful and need to apply by the label, and really consider, you know, weather and other conditions. Just kind of put people on alert that, hey, we're seeing these drift incidents, and you guys need to be aware of that and be more careful.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. If you could stay on the line, we're going to hear from Lisa Hansen and Katrina Hedberg from our Departments of Agriculture and Public Health, just to kind of respond to what we've heard here today, and maybe touch on a couple of the differences between the two states, that kind of thing. So if you could stay on the line just a little bit longer, that would be great.
Sure.
Chairman?
Yes,
while
Senator
people
Bates.
Coming up, I want to ask a minor question, really, to Mr. Clifford.
Please.
Mr. Clifford, this is Senator Bates. You don't know me, you don't know each other. You mentioned that you could get the medical records from victims without their consent, because you had a waiver for that. Is that a federal waiver you've gotten, so you don't have to worry about HIPAA?
Well, we are concerned about HIPAA, and we do protect the records. Although it's a statutory authority that exists in state law here.
What about federal law?
The agency as a whole has authority to request and store medical information.
What about federal law?
Well, we're not a HIPAA organization, although we We do are required to protect the medical records, so if they're electronic, they're stored in a secured server, and if they're paper, they're locked up, and staff are very diligent about that. And any time there's a request for public information, those records are gone through a review and redaction process to protect the identity of the people.
Thanks. I don't want to take up more today time.
Thank you. And that's something Dr. Hedberg can also address. Okay. Thank you very much. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'm Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the state health officer and state epidemiologist for the Oregon Public Health Division. I'm going to just briefly talk about what the role of the Public Health Division is related to pesticide exposures in Oregon. So we have a program at the Public Health Division called, fondly called PEST, but which stands for Pesticide Exposure Safety and Tracking Program. Our program actually only has a half an FTE, and the reason there's a less than sign here is because there's been level funding for this, and so as cost of living goes up, the funding goes down. And I think I'd be interested in hearing from Washington State as well. I think they have about five FTE who are looking into the pesticide exposures. So very similar to Washington State, the goal of our program is to understand the burden of acute pesticide illness and injury in Oregon, and then we assist in recommend the investigations by regulatory agencies, primarily Department of Agriculture, and we do report to the CDC as well. So again, Washington State talked about this, but the cases of pesticide exposure and related illness in Oregon are included in a national database, and so those contribute then to information that the EPA would use around regulation. We have a couple of relevant Oregon laws. Again, in the past, I know you all have heard about the statutes related to PARC, or the Pesticide Analytic Response Center, which Department of Agriculture is the primary authority there. But we have a couple specific to health. We have a statute around reportable disease that, by rule, we specify a list of reportable diseases. So this would be everything from a case of foodborne illness caused by salmonellosis or currently Ebola, et cetera. Those would be reported to us. And then specifically in rule, the reporting requirement related to pesticide is that healthcare providers shall report all human cases or suspected cases, human cases of pesticide poisoning to us. And again, there's a long list, and I've abbreviated it here. I think it's important to note that the requirement is related to healthcare provider reporting. We do collect information from citizens themselves, but again, that's a little bit different than reports of other diseases, which are either required from healthcare providers or from laboratories. So similar to Washington State, when we get information that there's been a case of pesticide exposure or related illness, we do interview the patient. And we want to get information about what product they have been potentially exposed to. And again, this is obviously if it's available from the person. We want to hear how the exposure occurred and everything from was this a residential, was it a worker who was applying in the process of agriculture, or was it one of these exposures that occurred environmentally. We want to hear about other contributing factors that may have happened at that time related to how the person became exposed to the pesticides, and then we question them about the onset and duration of symptoms. So just specifically the criteria that we have for an acute pesticide illness or injury is that they have a skin symptom, or something related to their eyes, or two systemic symptoms, such as respiratory, gastrointestinal. There's a whole list of things that pesticides can cause. And one of the issues we have is that it's not all that specific, unlike the symptoms of perhaps a gastrointestinal illness or something like meningitis that has more clear symptoms related to them. And again, we are part of the Pesticide Analytic Response Coordinating Center as well. So we follow up, similar to Washington State. We do use the CDC classification that's used by 11 other states, and I won't go into detail unless you all have questions about that. But it really relates to, are the symptoms compatible with the potential pesticide, and what's the toxicology of that pesticide? And then what is the exposure, and is there an immediate exposure, and did that happen before symptoms occurred, et cetera? So, again, we can go into more detail about that. And one of the goals that we have, again, I mentioned about reporting to nationally, but we also seek to identify what we call a causal pathway. And that, again, is the link between these things that we know, that there's a cause and effect, if you will, that the exposure happened and then the symptoms happened, and that there was some way that this person became exposed. So, for example, were they spraying rose bushes and then inhaling and then had symptoms resulting from that, or was it skin exposure, et cetera? I think it's important to note that we don't have any resources to identify any unknown pesticides, nor to conduct field investigations. So again, Washington State has many more resources related to their investigation of these public health issues. So I'm just briefly going to go over some of the data that we have to give you all an idea. Between 2009 and 2011, this is a list of where the exposures occurred and the reported illness that we had related to those. And as you can see, the vast majority, about two-thirds, were in residences. So you can think about that as people, for example, putting a bug bomb off in their house and then going into too soon afterwards and reporting some symptoms from that. Farm exposures, you can see here, it's about 17% of releases and 7% of the reported illnesses happened in the farm. Office or business, again, nursery is the list. Only one during this time period, and of course there have been more since then, but was related to exposure that occurred in a forest setting.
So Katrina, excuse me, yeah. What might be included under other?
Well, so you know, these pesticide exposures can occur in a variety of settings. So, for example, we know that a Department of Transportation uses a fair amount of pesticides on the sides of roadways, and so those might be adjacent to someone's house. A school related to, you know, we recently had where there was an agricultural field and they were using them and it was right next to a school and they were spraying on the line. Is that an exposure or not, et cetera? So, again, any setting you could imagine could be the possibility. The reason I listed them as other, although you're right, this is a significant or a fair percent, but each of these only accounted for one or two. So I didn't list out the whole list. This diagram shows the age groups of people exposed, and the highest age groups are in working age adults. Again, these are exposures that are happening either in the home or around the home or in the occupational settings. These tend not to be happening so much in the kind of environmental exposure that I know folks are concerned about. So in terms of follow-up actions, we do initiate actions for incidents that meet certain case criteria. Again, we have to classify cases, and obviously there's a separate category that we talk about, not just the likelihood, but the severity of illness. If it involves a death, those are ones that merit a significant follow-up action. Healthcare provider involvement, and again, really a fraction of the cases reported to us, someone has actually seen a healthcare provider, but if they have, that merits additional involvement. Work-related, I mentioned, and involves two or more people. So, again, it isn't just the bug bomb going off in the house, but rather there is something that is exposing people in the community more broadly. And, again, if PARC refers cases to us, we will do more investigation. We will do more interviews of those cases to try to figure out exactly what was happening in the situation. So the interagency collaboration, again, I've mentioned the Pesticide Analytic Response Center with Department of Agriculture taking the lead, but a number of agencies involved in that process. And again, you all have heard about that before. Particularly, we're in the process now of pulling together standard operating procedures involving these multi-household exposures. And we're going to have a meeting later this week to finalize those SOPs. So we have a big book, and we're going to go over those, I think, in a couple of days to make sure that all the agencies have contributed and that we agree. I think one of the main issues, of course, is the communication pathways, not only between agencies, but between the agencies and the general public or providers. So the multi-household event, this is just briefly, again, the SOPs are being finalized, but the trigger would be that two or more people in basically more than one household in a similar location, a community, would report symptoms after the same pesticide release. And we have a role in that, connecting the patients to local health care providers, making sure that information is out there, resources for those health care providers around the toxicology of the agents and how they might be treated, and then a role communicating within PARC. So this is shows a diagram about how, if you will, complicated communication is. The public health division is there at the top. We do work very closely with local health departments, but again, there's varying ability of those local health departments to investigate and interview cases. But we want to be sure that they're informed to do outreach to the community. Again, we inform proactively PARC and vice versa. We are part of PARC. Healthcare providers are on this list, and we collect case reporting from them, as well as we have the possibility of providing information through our health alert network to providers, and again, informing the general public about what the potential resources are for them. So the outreach for citizens themselves who might report, we really don't have the resources to do the physical examination or medical evaluation ourselves. So if people are really concerned about health and exposure, they need to seek a health care provider. And this is very similar to other reportable diseases. If somebody called and said, I have a stiff neck, we'd see you need to go into the emergency room and see a doctor. You may have meningitis. But we collect a lot of information after the fact to follow up and to ensure that there aren't more people who are being exposed. We refer any questions specific around pesticide toxicology. There's a National Pesticide Information Center that is located down at Oregon State University, and they are experts in the toxicology. There's a whole range, and there are hundreds of different pesticides, and so we really rely on them as the experts in this area. And then healthcare providers, in addition to the National Pesticide Information, the Poison Control Center, very similar to Washington State, have a close relationship, and if there are questions about how you treat an acute case and the symptoms related to that, the Poison Center really has a number of physicians who work for them. We do have a toxicologist at the Public Health Division who can provide advice, and again, he works across a number of programs. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Katrina. Why don't we hear from Lisa first and see if there are any questions. Thanks, Lisa.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. It was very interesting hearing about the Washington program, because I think you can draw so many similarities to the Oregon program. In Oregon, the Oregon Department of Agriculture is the state lead agency for the use of pesticides, the enforcement of the pesticide law, and the enforcement of the Federal Fungicide, Insecticide, and Rodenticide Act. Very similar in terms of how we operate and enforce the law. In terms of programs, those were similar as well. We have our compliance program, and we have, let me get the numbers, 9 investigators on the compliance side. We have our certification and registration program. Those are typically kind of combined. There's about 3 FTE in that area. We also have the Pesticide Analytical Response Center. And there is one FTE that's specifically dedicated to the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, which really is the cog when you talk about these multi-agency issues that cross-cut on pesticides. And then we also have a staff that's dedicated to the Pesticide Stewardship Program as well. So that gives you a little sense. I mean, similar, I think, in terms of the work. In terms of the number of cases, our complaint cases coming into the Department of Agriculture range between 200 and 250 annually. And then we have about the same number in terms of routine compliance investigations, where we're going out and looking at records. We may be doing observations of pesticide applications and other things. And then finally, in terms of our compliance part of the program, in terms of our tools, those sound very similar as well. We typically have what's known as a letter of advisement. That's something has happened, you need to be careful and work through the issues. A letter of violation. That would be in a case of some minor type of violation on a first offense. We also have civil penalty authority in which we will invoke, and we have authority to revoke and suspend a license under an emergency situation.
Okay, thank you. This is probably for both of you, and you know, it sounds as if there are some real differences between the two states in terms of human power working in the agencies. And does that affect the agency's ability to respond promptly to complaints? I mean, we heard that Washington had a fairly aggressive response rate. I mean, where they could go out and investigate that day or at the very latest the next day. Is that possible here in Oregon, or is that the practice here in Oregon, or do our, you know, employee limitations get in the way of that?
Members of the committee, I'll take a quick stab, and then I have Mike Odenthal, who is our lead pesticide investigator with the Department of Agriculture, who can definitely go into more detail with you.
Not too much detail, but...
As a matter of practice, we try to respond within 24 hours. That may be a call back to the individuals to collect more information and analyze it. And then we work to get out on the ground as soon as possible. But there is not, unlike Washington where there's a requirement, we don't have a requirement. Those are being more codified as we're working on the standard operating procedures for the agencies, the park member agencies. Dr. Hedberg referred to those earlier. We've visited with you about them several times, and the directors will be getting together later this week to really work on formalizing and looking to see if there are any additional areas where we would need to work to respond. Mike, is there anything you would want to add to that?
Chair Dembro, Mike Odenthal, lead investigator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The only thing I would say is sometimes geography does play a large role in the response time. We have six investigators scattered throughout the state. Generally, we can respond within a district within 3 to 4 hours, but that sometimes precludes getting out there that same day.
So, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, if I may. So, because we only have half an FTE, he's not on site every single day, nor is the role been defined for the Public Health Division to respond, if you will, to an immediate event. It is related, and again, Washington State's had similar data collection, analysis, interpretation, and then use for preventing these events in the future. Were there to be some emergency on a very large scale, we do have, of course, our emergency preparedness program that's been very involved in, for example, responding to Ebola currently, just as an example. And they certainly could be, if there were a one-time event, let's say a pesticide truck, turned over and there was a major release or whatever, we would be able to do that. But when it comes to the general, sort of the ongoing types of exposures, we do not have the ability to, or the resources to respond on an immediate basis.
Yes, Representative Leininger, and welcome.
Thank you. Well, thanks for being here. This is helpful. I have a question about access to information for people who are concerned that they've been exposed to pesticides, particularly in a multi-individual, multi-household exposure incident. I've had a number of people express concern to me that they feel like they were, and then in Oregon, they had a hard time getting information about the substances to which they were exposed, which impeded their ability to seek healthcare treatment. And I'm wondering if you can, everybody, including the folks on the call, if you can help me understand the difference between Oregon's approach and Washington's approach to enabling people to find out after the fact of a perceived exposure what the stuff was so they can get help.
Lisa, do you want to address that? Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, thank you for the question. So as a general course of action in a pesticide investigation, we will make contact with the pesticide applicator to obtain the pesticide use information. And generally, we will make that available to the individual who has been impacted. We're required to make it available to a physician should they request it. We've talked about that before. I think where concerns have been raised more recently is the event in Curry County, which was a very challenging event. We've talked to the committee about that previously, in which The information was not readily forthcoming in that case, which is very unusual. And then when we had initial information from the applicator and began to get back test results from the laboratory, those did not match. And we were very concerned about the discrepancies. And this is some time had passed since the initial event. And so there were challenges. There clearly were challenges around Curry County. But as a normal course of an investigation, that information is typically readily available once we request it from an applicator.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
So does that mean, you know, within 6 hours, the person who's going to the doctor can get it, or 6 days or 6 weeks? I don't know what the time frame is, and if someone could help me understand how that works in Washington, that would be great.
This is Joel. I am having a little bit of difficulty hearing all the questions and conversation. If someone maybe could repeat that question.
Sure. Here the question was the extent to which the chemicals that were involved in the mix in the application are shared with the public, you know, after, you know, during the course of an investigation. You know, most notably with the people, the individuals who are complaining.
Yeah, we don't have a strict policy on that or anything. And I would just say that if that information becomes available, our investigators would likely talk to the complainants about that. And then, of course, if we've done sample analysis, as soon as we have residue results back from the lab, we do share that with as a procedure. We share that with both the complainant and the applicator. So, but it's not something we would try to hide or anything like that. It would be if we know what was applied, our investigator as a normal course would share that with the complainant.
Yeah, this is Wayne with Washington Department of Health. And it's very similar for us. We, if we're in contact with the patient, as soon as we learn what the pesticide was applied, we would call them and let them know, as well as if their physician was asking, they'd do the same thing.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Colleagues, we've reached the end of our time for this hearing. This is an issue we'll continue to hear about. As you heard, the protocols, the standard operating procedures that the agencies have been working on as a result of the incident in Curry County and the hearings that we've been having are, I think, nearing completion. And, you know, I'm very excited to see what those look like, and they you know, they have the potential to really improve the situation going forward. Once those are finalized, we'll share them with everyone in the committee or interested parties, and look forward to your feedback on that. Okay, again, thank you very much for being here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a quick comment, if I could.
Please.
Following on your comments, there seems to be two major problems here. When I keep looking at the people in the front row here who are impacted by this and have not had a chance to speak today, but I remember them. They're not my direct constituents, but they're Oregonians. When I look at this, I think of two things. One, we may need to look very carefully at our guidelines we're using in the state for aerial spraying. We've got good actors out there and probably some bad actors. I think the bad actors are making the good actors look bad. And so we need to look at that very carefully, maybe mimic what's going on in Washington. And the other thing is we have to really consider whether or not our lead agencies are the right agencies. They're in a very conflicted position of looking into these issues when they're trying to represent the forest industry or agriculture interests and the public at the same time. We may be looking at a situation here where we put them in an impossible situation. I would rather see a hotline to DEQ or a hotline to public health for people to call in on, get an immediate response, and then have that agency or whatever agency we choose then talk to and work with Ag or Department of Forestry. I just think the system's set up to fail. and we'll have more failures like this if we don't make a change in how we go about the process. So I'd offer those two observations, hoping that the people who are working on this will take a consideration of that also. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate those comments. Okay, so with that, it's time to move on to our next topic. Are they still on the line? Sorry, I didn't say goodbye. Anyway, thank you to our colleagues from Washington. We're moving on to the next topic, which is about Oregon's electricity mix and the role of coal in that mix. We normally would have had this presentation follow immediately on the one about the 111D because they're very closely related in many ways, but we needed to accommodate our witnesses from Washington. So I hope you remember what we were talking about 45 minutes ago and put your heads back into that space. We have two panels here. The first includes Ezra Hausman, Jeff Bissonnette, and Rachel Shimshak. We're going to do this in two panels, Shelley. Yeah. And then we'll have Varner Seaman and Scott Bolton. We have about a half hour for this topic, so I need you to be precipitous. So please start.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak today, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My recent report.
Pastor, yes. Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Sure.
My name is Ezra Hausman.
Thank you.
Okay. And I have given to a staff member here the copies of a recent report that I wrote, which was commissioned by the Sierra Club on risks and opportunities for PacifiCorp. This report focuses on the sources of energy for PacifiCorp and Pacific Power customers. And one point I emphasize is that while Oregon itself has abundant renewable energy and one of the cleanest in-state energy mixes in the country, Oregonians get about a third of their power from out-of-state coal plants. And in particular, Pacific Power customers get about two-thirds of their energy sourced from out-of-state coal plants. Given the way that the energy markets and energy regulation works in this area, this puts Pacific Power customers at considerable risk. Utilities around the country, including PacifiCorp, are facing billions of dollars in capital investments to keep their coal plants running. This includes costs to reduce air and water pollution, to reduce water resource depletion, to protect aquatic life, to clean up leaky and dangerous solid waste storage systems, and so forth. My report includes a table, Table 1, which shows the emission control status of each of PacifiCorp's individual units and a rough estimate of what the cost would be to bring each of those units up to full compliance with what they're likely to face in the coming years from federal regulations. The numbers are quite daunting. If anyone tells you that clean energy is expensive, make sure you're getting a full accounting of what the costs are of so-called business as usual, of bringing all these plants into compliance and keeping them running. And I have not even mentioned the cost of greenhouse gas emissions under 111D regulation or whatever else comes into place in the coming years and decades. In addition to the environmental costs and risks, the costs of coal and coal transportation have been increasing, while the cost of alternatives have been decreasing dramatically. We all know about the lower cost of natural gas in recent years and lower projections going forward. But even more dramatic, persistent, and robust are the technological advances and cost reductions for renewable resources. The PacifiCorp region and specifically Oregon, is extremely well positioned to benefit from these low cost and low risk resources, creating jobs and building the clean energy economy close to home. My report goes into specifically quantifying the potential of various renewable resources and the jobs benefits associated with each of these kinds of resources. Excuse me. Looming over all of this are the risks and costs that coal plants and other fossil resources face associated with their greenhouse gas emissions and disruptions to the climate. These costs can be looked at two ways. There's the almost incalculable cost associated with doing nothing and having uncontrolled climate change. And there's the more quantifiable and much lower financial cost of complying with the inevitable federal rules that will address this issue. It simply does not make sense for Oregon ratepayers to continue throwing good money after bad on resources that will continue to impose these costs and risks on both the planet and on the economy of the state and the nation when so many cleaner, safer, and local options are available. And I look forward to answering your question when the time comes.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hausman. Dr. Hausman, could you just very quickly say something about your background?
So I have a doctorate, as you allude to, in atmospheric chemistry, so climate science. And for the last 17 years or so, I've worked in energy markets, resource planning cases all over the country, on behalf of a number of clients, including state and federal agencies, environmental groups such as the Sierra Club, working with the Department of Justice, so a lot of state consumer advocates as well. So I bring both a climate background and many years in energy markets and energy economics.
Thank you very much. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities focused on electricity, natural gas, and telecommunications utilities. And also, as of January of this year, water and sewer services for the city of Portland. Here just to make two quick points, one to pick up on the risk theme that Dr. Hausman underscored. And for several years now, we've been operating as consumers under a fair amount of risk from potential coal investment. We do not have a comprehensive climate policy in this state, in this country. And what that does is lead us to a point where we don't know the rules of the game. We don't know how to precisely calculate risk because we don't know what the eventual climate policy will be. And there will eventually be one. We just don't know what it is or when it'll arrive. And so we, as ratepayers, are being asked to make very long-term investments sometime in the neighborhood of 30, 40, 50 years. Today, without that clarity, and so what that does in terms of coal and being asked to invest in coal is put our money at risk, because if we make those investments, a comprehensive climate policy gets established. Those resources that are cheap today get a lot less cheap and a lot less efficient, and so we lose that investment there, and we also have to then make further investment in replacement resources. Without, it would be much better to know today what we're doing. We don't, and so we have to sort of do the best we can, but it's definitely a risk factor that we operate with. My second point is that coal today, even if we do nothing, is not free. We are being asked, again, as ratepayers, to invest great sums of money into coal plants just for existing clean air and haze rules put down by the federal government. Back a few years ago, we were being asked to put forth about $500 million in investment in the Boardman coal plant so that it could be compliant with clean air and haze rules for the gorge. what we started to ask at CUB was, is there a better way to spend ratepayer money? Can we spend a little bit of money to make some upgrades and then but have enough time to close the plant and have invest our money in cleaner resources and a cleaner resource mix? And eventually, after long discussion, the customer advocates and many other environmental advocates, and the utility, Portland General Electric in this case, came up with the fact that we could make some investment and then close the plant in 2020. And that was not only a benefit for the environment, but it was actually a benefit for ratepayers as well. And it's those kind of scenarios that we're looking at and looking for as we go forth and really looking at the economic viability of coal plants that we are being asked as ratepayers to invest in. So we, again, risk is already here. Coal is not cheap and is not free. And so what you'll hear from utilities and others is that you know, there may be a lot of money required from the ratepayers. Ratepayers are already paying a lot. Ratepayers are being asked to pay a lot. The question before us is there a better way to spend ratepayer money? With that, I'll leave it for further discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Shimshak.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Shimshak. I'm the Executive Director of Renewable Northwest. We're a regional advocacy organization. We promote the responsible development of renewables in Oregon and in the rest of the region. And our members are both businesses and consumer groups and environmental groups who are aligned in wanting to make our future a clean one. The other panelists talked a little bit about the risks and costs related to coal in our energy supply, and I really wanted to talk to you about the opportunity that that renewables have to help us move away from coal and really strengthen our energy resources. Renewables have lots of benefits. They have local economic benefits. They help diversify our supply. Renewables are really great in the energy mix because they allow for stable prices over the life of a project. A renewable resource is mostly capital, so you know the cost of a resource for the next 30 years. It's very, you can't really say that by about many other resources, and of course there's no fuel costs. So low risk, low environmental impact, and good for the economy and good for the environment. We believe that the transition from coal to clean energy is really part of the Oregon story. We have a really successful history in building and supplying renewable energy resources in Oregon, and we're actually recognized as a national leader for doing this. We're in the top 10 states for developing wind, and our utilities have some of the best voluntary green power programs in the country. As others have said, we have this generous endowment of new renewable resources. We have lots of wind and solar and geothermal. We have a budding wave industry off of our coast. We have biomass. And, of course, all of this is built on the foundation of our hydro system. So in our energy parlance, a megawatt of wind, for instance, is about enough to serve 250 households in the state. And we already have 3,000 megawatts of wind in our state. And importantly, about 1,700 megawatts of projects that have already gone through the permitting process and are just waiting for a chance to compete to supply Oregon's electricity. We have a lot of experience building and integrating these resources into our supply, and it has really proven to be a very important financial benefit for the state. So far, wind, solar, and geothermal have invested $9 billion in the state of Oregon, and that's a pretty big deal. And between those two resources, generated over 500 jobs. Importantly, the costs are falling. Wind, the cost of wind has fallen by half just since 2009, and I've kind of waited my whole life for this part, but solar is now 80% cheaper than it was just 5 years ago. operations are improving. We have better scheduling for these resources, and with some additional modernization of the transmission system, we believe that these renewable resources can help supply reliable service and, importantly, ancillary services to help balance the system. Both PGE and Pacific Power have shown leadership in addressing some climate challenges. Jeff talked about PGE working with advocates to identify the benefits of closing the Boardman plant and hopefully replacing it with a lot of clean energy. Pacific Core and PGE have a lot of experience purchasing and developing renewable resources for their supply. But there is much more to do to create a clean energy 21st century supply for customers in Oregon. And we know that Oregonians want it. We know that we have the knowledge and the skills to deliver it. We just need the will. Thank you.
Thank you, all three of you. Any questions for the panel?
I have one.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you very much, ma'am, for that insightful presentation. But a question I have for you is, how do we depend on renewables since the wind is variable and the sun is variable? So how do we, I know we can integrate them into the mix, but what's the backup fuel that we use to make certain that when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, we can turn the lights on?
Thank you very much for asking the question. It's a very, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it's a very popular question for people to ask. And I think we are learning that we can depend on renewables for quite a few things. I said that previously that the technology that wind uses these days can produce a lot of ancillary services that that weren't always available at the early years of wind energy, and so can solar. You need voltage support and you need inertia in order to make a system work, and all resources contribute together to make those things possible. It's really important when you think of wind and solar to think of the attributes that they do have. Solar obviously shows up during the daytime and can help reduce the peak that we have and when we're using our electricity. Wind, as long as it is geographically dispersed around the region, there are different wind regimes. So if you have wind in Montana that peaks in the winter and you couple that with wind in the gorge that peaks in the spring and summer, you really help use renewables to manage people's electricity consistently over time. There will certainly need to be other resources in the supply, but we think we know enough now to be able to really accelerate the amount of clean energy that we have in our supply and do it carefully with the help of the utilities, with the Public Utility Commission, and with the advocates who participate in those processes.
Yes, Senator Hansel.
Quick question. I just want to make sure I got your figures right. We've invested private and public funds of over $9 billion to create 500 jobs, permanent jobs, and it factors out about $18.5 million per job. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the renewable energy industry, solar manufacturing, and building of projects all over the state have invested $9 billion, which is a lot of money. That investment has resulted in about 5,000 jobs across the state. Some of those are permanent jobs to operate the facilities, and some of those are construction jobs to actually build the facilities.
Permanent jobs is what I was after.
Yes.
I think you said 500.
I didn't say, but it is included in the fact sheet that we presented to each of the committee members.
Okay, so permanent jobs are 500 for a $9.5 billion investment.
Plus the construction jobs and the local economic revenue that counties receive from the investment in these resources. Nice part about renewables is that there are manufacturing facilities and businesses on the west side that are contributing to this, and also the projects themselves that are largely found on the east side. Many of those counties on the east side have been able to make it through the last 5 years because of the investment that a lot of these resources have made, not to mention the landowners who lease their lands and actually get some of the leased money to help keep them in the farming business because it diversifies them.
My question is, according to your fact sheet, $9.5 billion investment, and out of that we have 500 permanent jobs.
500 permanent jobs, 5,000 jobs total.
Okay. I have one follow-up question, if you don't mind.
Actually, I think we have to move on to the next panel. Thank you all for being here with us. I think, you know, the what we heard is a call for perhaps replicating what worked with PGE and the Boardman plant with Pacific Power and the coal that's coming into the state. And so it's time for us to move on to hear from those two illustrious entities in the form of Varner Seaman and Scott Bolton.
Good morning. Chairman Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Varner Seaman. I work for Portland General Electric in the Government Affairs Department. Hearing some of the earlier testimony was a little bit troublesome because folks kind of took a little bit of what I was wanting to talk about with the shutdown of the Boardman facility, but I'll go ahead and kind of briefly talk about it anyway, if you'll indulge me. With maybe a little bit more detail and fleshing out the narrative about what took place with Boardman, what's yet to come with Boardman, in a little bit more detail. So as a regulated utility serving load in the state of Oregon, Portland General Electric goes through a series of pretty robust planning processes. The main planning process that we do is what's called an integrated resource plan that is updated every couple years, and we do a look ahead for what our resources are and what we expect demand to be for electricity within our service territory. And the basic factor that we're looking at is, are we going to have enough power to serve load when load needs to be met? And what we do in planning is we say, okay, what's the most power we think we're going to need through the course of the year, and we plan for that. Sort of interesting, you'd think that this is a fairly straightforward exercise. There's sort of an ongoing trend in our service territory where as more folks are getting air conditioners, we're seeing that instead of having just a winter peak, we're also having a summer peak and some different needs to be able to meet that peak capacity or that peak load. So we go through that process at the PUC. There's pretty robust stakeholder involvement. A lot of the folks that you heard from earlier today participate in that process for both us and for PacifiCorp. And we talk with advocates and we say, okay, let's plan for what we need to have. We work with industrial customers. We work with other business interests to say, okay, how much are we going to need to have? And the principle that we look at as we're planning for what the resources are that we'll need to have available to us to meet that peak load is based on the principle of what is the least risk and what's the least cost. And when we started to look at the Boardman facility a number of years ago and our planners were going through the work that they do looking at all of our resources and what the resource needs are, there was a determination made that it may be in the best interest of customers to retire that facility for the purpose of burning coal and look at moving in a different direction. So working with PUC staff, working with the commissioners of the Public Utilities Commission, working with DEQ, Department of Energy, United States EPA, advocates, ratepayer groups here in the state of Oregon, there was a decision made that by December 31st, 2020, we will no longer burn coal at the Boardman Coal Facility. Now, for the state of Oregon, I think that, as people were alluding to earlier, becomes pretty important for meeting whatever our 111D obligation is. We think that was a sound decision, and we stand by that decision. We think that's absolutely the right path for us going forward. In the next integrated resource plan process that PGE is about to start, and we do this every 2 years, so it's kind of a rolling cycle that we look at, we're going to be taking on the question of what do we do for the replacement of that power at Boardman. We haven't figured that out yet. There's going to be a lot of analysis that goes into it, a lot of looking at various resources, looking at the capacity that those resources bring to the table, looking at the cost of those resources, and kind of putting that together in a package, and then going out and most likely procuring some additional generation assets to be able to meet that that energy that we're no longer going to be producing from the Boardman facility. Now, Boardman's about a 550-megawatt coal facility, so it's a pretty good slug of energy. At PGE, we think that the planning process that we have is a pretty effective one. We stand by that process. There are a lot of factors that go into the decisions to buy resources, not just the cost factors, but the performance of how those resources work on the grid. Rachel from Renewable Northwest earlier talked about things like voltage support and VARs and inertia on the grid, and that's true. Those are things that we have to plan for. And as we get down into the spreadsheets and we start talking to the experts in these areas, we try to come up with the best picture to make sure that we can actually meet that load, and so the lights come on when customers want the lights to come on. With that said, it's a pretty complex process, and we think that belongs at the PUC. It's appropriately at the PUC, and especially as we look at 111D coming forward with the new federal regulations. I think one of the things that was talked about earlier is eventually there will be carbon regulation at the federal level. There actually is for the utility sector. It's not economy-wide. We would have preferred an economy-wide approach. PGE lobbied in favor of the cap-and-trade federal program in 2009. Preferring an economy-wide approach and one that would affect all states. 111D we don't think is perfect, but we think that's the regulation that we're going to have on carbon going forward, and we intend to comply with it and build it into our planning scenarios. And I think there was Jeff with CUB earlier maybe anticipated something he was expecting to hear in testimony, which is concerns about cost for customers. And I think that I would say we are concerned about the cost for customers. All resource decisions we make are going to have some cost associated with them. And again, we're committed to planning for the least cost, least risk, and we think the planning principles that we have are appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Varner. Scott.
Great, Mr. Chair, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Power. And I know we're a little pressed for time, so I will move as quickly as I can. But just to orient you a little bit to who Pacific Corp is, we're a six-state integrated utility serving Oregon, Washington, California, Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming. And that constitutes about 1.8 million customers across that region, about 12,000 megawatt generation portfolio. And just a really quick bit of history, Pacific Corp today really is comprised of the merger of Pacific Power and Light and Utah Power and Light back in 1989. And the idea behind that marriage was you're taking a West Coast utility that primarily takes advantage of generation of hydropower, where we have a lot of water resource, with a Rocky Mountain-based utility that is located strategically along coal seams. And so back then, it made a lot of sense to have a balanced portfolio between those two resources. And as you can see from the myriad of dots and triangles and different things along the map, we've added a lot of other technologies since that time, including wind, solar, geothermal, and while still trying to maximize what we already get out of those legacy resources. And then all that stitched together with the largest private transmission system in the West. So we do have a large transmission system. We continue to look for opportunities to upgrade and add to that as it makes sense to serve customers across the region. One other note before I move off this slide is that we're regulated on an integrated basis. So if you look at all of the assets on that map, whether they're generation or transmission assets, they're shared among those six states. And then the costs are allocated based on the loads of those states. So Oregon right now is probably a hair under 30% of the load. And so if you imagine, if you will, all of the cost and benefit of these resources being put into a large bucket and then ladled out based on the use of the system. And just a quick snapshot, here is what Pacific Power, which is our retail business in the western states, looks like in Oregon, our footprint. As you can see, pretty scattered across the state. There's not a region of the state that we don't have customers or property within. And as you can see, it's a pretty rural customer base outside of our Northeast Portland and a little bit of downtown service territory. It really is reflective of much of rural Oregon, and the customer density per line mile is much lower than PGE as an investor-owned utility. So I spent a little bit of time on this slide, and this is our 2013 Integrated Resource Plan. As Varner described, investor-owned utilities in the state go through very robust planning processes to look at their energy mix, what customer needs may be in the future, what technology and market prices are showing us, and try to have a very transparent and thorough plan to meet those needs. If you went back, it doesn't show up on this slide, but if you went back to 2004, PacifiCorp probably had about 80% of its energy mix reliant on coal. As we close the books on 2014, it's about 61%. And then as you look across the current planning period, by 2022 will be below 50%, and 2032 will be below 30%. So there isn't a question of whether coal is part of our resource mix or not long term. As time goes, it will be less and less so until the point where we probably do not have coal in our mix as we transition out of that resource. It should be noted that the most recent coal power plant in our system is a vintage of 1986. So these plants are getting older, and they're starting to live out their useful life. And so you really can start seeing a glide path there. And as I like to describe, it's really a slide rule exercise over how much time it takes to really start working through that remaining investment. I should also note in this slide that in 2004, PacifiCorp had under 40 megawatts of wind. Over the 10 years since 2004, we've increased that by 40 times to just under 1,700 megawatts of wind. So we are building up our renewable base while we are starting to transition from coal and adding, and frankly, filling that gap as well with natural gas and energy efficiency. I won't spend a lot of time on this slide. This is the resulting emissions trend that you'll see associated with the energy mix I just showed you. Probably the most notable thing within this is that a lot of what you'll see around emissions curves are fairly straight line exercises. And our reality is that it's pretty lumpy, that it's not just an exact mirror of your energy mix with where your emissions are at. It has a lot of other factors to consider as well, including load growth, including what other types of resources come on or off your system at different times. I think what this does show is that emissions will trend down as our coal mix trends down. I'm really glad to not have to go through the primer of 111D, and that we had a lot of smart people from the state to explain that to the committee earlier. What I would say is that we believe this does constitute comprehensive carbon regulation as it applies to the electricity sector. This is the Clean Air Act regulation for fossil fuel power plants. And as we look at this, one of the things that I think is really important is the building block approach that the Environmental Protection Agency has adopted. If you look at these building blocks, whether it's power plant efficiency, redispatch of natural gas versus coal, and basically what that means is use less coal, use more gas, use more renewables, basically dispatch your resources based on their environmental profile, not necessarily on pure cost consideration. Adding renewable energy, using more energy efficiency, these are all things that we know how to do, we have done, and can certainly do more of. So these are actions that we know result in emissions reductions, and we think that it's a good basis for which to look at how to reduce carbon output from power plants and in our electricity system. Obviously, each state has its own self-interest in putting together its implementation plan for meeting the EPA rules. Because of the diversity and the footprint of Pacific Corp system across the West, we think that that's a good dynamic, but we also are strongly encouraging our states to work together. Just as we optimize our generation resources across the fleet, we also think that there's great opportunity to optimize our compliance capability across the fleet. And if done right, that is going to be very respectful of our customers and ratepayers' pocketbooks. So we think 111D, there's still a lot of questions yet to be answered as far as what the final rule looks like, but we do think it's workable, and we do think we can meet federal carbon requirements. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much, Scott. Colleagues, we really don't have time for questions. I'm sorry. This is a very timely and useful introduction to a topic that I know we're going to be exploring in the next session. And I really appreciate the clarity of the presentations. And I know that these individuals are all open to your questions offline as you can. So thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm going to have us go into a very quick work session right now. One of the things we have to do, this being the last meeting of the year, is to introduce committee bills. So I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills. Colleagues, remember the purpose of this activity is to put bills into the mix. They do not reflect upon our feelings about the content of the bills. You already know about four, and there is actually a fifth. So, is that right? Yes. So let me let's just get that started, and give you a quick identification of what these LCs are. So, Vice Chair Olson.
Oh. Chair Demereaux, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2126, dated 11/5/14; LC 2128, dated 10/24/14; LC 2134, dated 10/23/14; LC 2138, dated 11/5/14; and LC 2147, dated 12/5/14.
Vice Chair Olson has moved that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2126, dated 11/5/14; LC 2128, dated 10/24/14; LC 2134, dated 10/23/14; LC 2138, dated 11/5/14; and finally, LC 2147, dated 12/5/14. Just quickly, these are nearly all bills that would create task forces on subjects that have potential interest, one having to do with creating a process for looking at consolidation of some of our natural resource agencies to make them more efficient and effective. Another on ocean acidification and steps needed to accommodate the increase in ocean acidification. Another on wood stoves, the use of wood stoves, and creating a program to help consumers move towards more efficient wood stoves or convert to other more efficient fuel sources, a task force on looking at next steps for the clean air fee that we're about to hear about, and then finally one that we just received, which is provide some technical updates to our energy efficiency standards. So any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to our entering these as committee bills, adopting these as committee bills? Seeing none, these LCs are adopted. With that, I will close the work session and open our final topic, which is the report on Senate bill, whatever it is, 630 or on the clean air fee or tax. Sorry for the delay, but we look forward to hearing this. We would have preferred to have you first, and then you could have taken the entire 3 hours. You chose to do the Revenue Committee first. So please come.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vacate my seat. We have a panel of five people. The only thing Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue, I would have to say, this is a compliance with our obligation to you on Senate Bill 306 to put in front of you this report. If one of your audience would give us an extra chair here, would be great. We have five people that would present to you, and I'll be around in case you need any further discussions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mazen. So why don't you come up, panel? And let me say it just as you're getting seated. I want to first of all, thank you all for the excellent work that you've done so far. From what I've seen, it's very, very high quality. And we're excited to see this next step in the process.
Okay. Good morning. Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Petowski. I'm a director of the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University and a professor of economics at the same university. And if I may just intercede and ask, Mr. Chair, how much time do we have?
We have until 11.
It's 11? Okay. Thank you very much. With me today is also Jeff Renfro, senior economist, Dr. Jenny Liu, assistant director of NERC and assistant professor at PSU, Dr. Chris Butanoff, assistant professor of physics at PSU, and also Dr. Andrew Rice, associate professor of physics at PSU. And also I wanted to mention another author of the study who's with us today, who's sitting behind me, Michael Parish. I practice and practice his name. Mike Parashevics. Mike, where are you? Shout it out.
Parashevich.
You think with a name like mine, I should be able to. All right, just quickly on the background, we did a previous study on carbon tax and shift, and that was presented to committees here at the state legislature. Senate Bill 306 was passed and made effective in August. An RFP process went out. NERC was chosen to assist Legislative Revenue Office. And we basically went over a little more than a year period of time in order to do this study. Just to let you know, the green bullet points here is just to tell you that we didn't do this in a vacuum, sitting in our offices with computers. We met with LRO monthly. We had a technical advisory committee. Membership is on page one of your report. We met with stakeholder groups, utilities, businesses, labor groups, advocacy groups from environmental to low income to business associations, and then actually met with other legislative committees along the way and met with LRO about weekly as we're finishing up the report. And so we are here today in front of you. So very quickly, on limiting carbon emissions, when you don't have a price on something, that item tends to either be overproduced or overused. And given the externality, the costs associated with carbon emissions, there is no price, no ownership of it, and thus, in essence, it's overproduced in our economy. And there is ways to decrease those emissions. One is regulatory controls, which we will talk about as we go along. And then the other is to do a market mechanism. And this is then actually, let's put a price on those carbon emissions. There's two ways to do it. What we'll talk today about is the carbon tax approach. Basically, what we're trying to do is put incentives to change behavior through either being more efficient in the use of your energy, conservation, alternative energy sources, investment in energy-saving investments, our technologies, or in essence, with the price, we're allowing the market mechanism to work so that businesses and households find the best way for them to reduce the carbon emissions, and hopefully thus in the least cost way. Very broadly, top, 100,000 foot view here, what we're looking at very dynamically. You put a carbon tax on, that carbon tax then will create carbon tax revenues. There will be emission reductions. How does that affect the economy? And then on top of it, what do you do with those carbon revenues? Tax revenues. If you repatriate back, which is saying lowering various tax rates on businesses and households, what does that do to the economy? And then so we do this dynamically. You have a tax. You reduce emissions. That affects businesses. The taxes are used somehow that go back into the economy. The economy then reacts to that. They're going to have a different level of economic activity. That's a different level of emissions. Different level of emissions has a tax on it. That creates revenues, and thus you have this dynamic aspect that we try to analyze. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Liu.
For the record, my name is Jenny Liu, and thank you, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. So in the interest of time, I think we'll leave more time to show you more of the results of our scenarios and not go through the detailed methodology that I have here. Please refer to the methodology section to go through kind of our process. How do we model different carbon price levels? How does it feed into the economy? And then thus, how does that generate revenues that then feed into various scenarios of how to use that revenue that kind of cycle through and dynamic generating process in our economy. Kind of to begin, everything is compared to a baseline that we forecast into the future, both for the economy and also for emissions. So the baseline is basically a portrayal of what happens to our Oregon economy and emissions if we did not have any carbon tax. So just business as usual going forward with all the policies that are in place, what would happen? So I will turn the table over now to the other side of the table.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Jeff Renfro. Also, in the interest of time, I'll just say that this is a schematic that shows the relationship between our different revenue repatriation and expenditure scenarios that we modeled. This is from the report, but then also in the second appendix of the report, we have a much more detailed version of the schematic and a write-up of how these things all fit together. But I'm going to skip ahead and just give you a few examples of our scenario types. What we call the A scenarios, we look at what would happen if basically the government didn't send this money, didn't send the revenues back to the economy. So we look at a scenario in which the state government keeps the revenues in a financial reserve. Even though we think that this is unlikely, our reason for doing it is if the federal government were to impose a carbon tax and they use the revenues in a way that did not benefit the Oregon economy, this might be something similar to what we would see. We also, conceptually, we wanted to see what the sort of economic harm on the front end of the policy was due to the increase in energy prices. So we wanted to know the type of employment hole we basically had to dig ourselves out of with the use of the revenues. In the B scenarios, those are truly revenue neutral scenarios. Very early in our process, we talked to legislative counsel about restrictions on revenue uses. They told us, basically with no ambiguity, that if a carbon tax is imposed on transportation fuels, those revenues would have to go to the Highway Trust Fund based on constitutional requirements. So the use of transportation-related revenues end up becoming a big driver of the results in our report. So in the B scenarios, all of the revenue, the transportation revenues are used to reduce existing gas taxes and other transportation and transportation-related fees and taxes. And then the non-transportation revenues are used to reduce corporate and personal income tax rates. In the C scenarios, we take the transportation-related revenues and we give that to the Highway Trust Fund and model that. We use the rest of the revenue to reduce corporate and personal income tax rates. We also model citizen dividend scenarios, so it's based on the Alaska model for the use of oil revenues. Our D scenarios, we look at using revenues to target other specific policy priorities. So we know that this tax is potentially regressive because lower income people tend to spend a higher proportion of their income on energy related purchases. So we look at ways to offset that negative impact, both on low income people generally, but then also on workers and industries that might be negatively affected by the tax. We also look at different ways for targeting industry support. We model exemptions of certain industries, and we also model using revenues to set up sort of an investment fund to offset negative impacts. And then we also look at using some of the revenues to fund energy efficiency projects. Our last group of scenarios, the E scenarios, we take that transportation revenue. We assume that that is still spent on transportation-related projects, but we assume that the constitutional requirement is relaxed or changed in some way. So examples of that, the way that the Highway Trust Fund is currently dispersed around the state, it's based on a weighted VMT, or weighted vehicle mile traveled formula. So we unweight that formula to see what would happen. We also look at using some of those funds for transportation that isn't just highway construction and maintenance. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris and Drew. Oh.
And really quickly, before we launch into the results, we modeled the tax on all fossil fuel combustion here in Oregon. So that includes petroleum, natural gas, also electricity that's produced here in Oregon, as well as any imported electricity that is produced elsewhere but consumed here in Oregon. And the range of tax rates that we modeled range anywhere from $10 per metric ton of CO2 equivalent to $150 per ton.
Right. For the record, my name is Chris Butenhoff. I'm assistant professor at Department of Physics at Portland State University. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, thank you. So the first slide that we want to show you presents the emissions results. And just to kind of orientate you a little bit to this graph, on the left-hand vertical axis, we have the energy-related emissions in units of millions of metric tons of CO2 equivalent. And then we thought it also would be useful to show these emissions relative to the 1990 emissions. Members of the committee might know that Oregon has the target of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 10% by the year 2020 and by 75% by the year 2050. So the first, and that's what the dotted line shows. So the dotted line shows the 1990 reference point. The green line are the baseline emissions. So again, these are the emissions that we forecast, assuming no carbon tax. And this roughly represents a, over this interval of time, this is about a 10% increase in emissions since 2012. Another way of thinking about this is about 13% increase over about the 1990 level. So just to kind of summarize that point, under a no carbon tax scenario, we'd expect emissions to be about 13% above the 1990 level. Next are all the various emission forecasts for the different carbon tax rates. So again, each of those color lines represents the emissions forecasts for a different carbon tax level. And one point I just want to emphasize here, Tom mentioned that depending upon how the tax revenue is repatriated or spent, that will have a feedback to the economy. And in principle, that feedback to the economy will have a feedback to the fuel demand, and that fuel demand, of course, will have a feedback to the emissions. So in principle, these emission forecasts should be different for each of the various A through E scenarios that Jeff just talked about. But in practice, what we find is the differences between those scenarios are very small in the emissions sphere. So we're only seeing maybe a 1 to 1.5% difference in the emissions for each of those different repatriation and expenditure scenarios. So these results we're showing you right here are for the C4 scenario. This is for the scenario where the transportation fuel revenue is given back to the Highway Trust Fund, and then the rest of the revenue is split 70 corporate tax, reduction of corporate income tax, and then 30 personal income tax. So the main point here is just want to emphasize that under each of these carbon tax scenarios, we do see a reduction relative to the baseline. Starting with a carbon tax rate of $30 per ton, we actually get below the 1990 emissions. And starting at a tax rate of $60 per ton, we actually do meet the 2020 target of reducing emissions 10% by the year 2020. The farthest out that we model is the year 2034. And the most extreme case with a $150 tax scenario, we're getting a reduction of about 40%. So just to emphasize that that carbon tax alone would not be sufficient to meet the 75% reduction target goal in the future. And then this is just kind of a very quick summary of essentially that that table. Again, each of the different carbon tax scenarios, the emissions and reduction from baseline and the change from the 1990 level are given. And again, just want to point out for the $10, we see about a 7% reduction from the baseline up to about a 43% reduction up for the $150 carbon tax rate. And again, just to point out that the only only the $10 tax scenario do we actually see emissions higher than 1990. For all the other tax rates, we actually see reduction relative to the 1990 level.
Good morning, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrew Rice, Department of Physics at PSU. So some of the power of our approach really is to break out emissions by region, by economic sector, by fuel type. I'm just going to show one slide here that breaks down emissions by the regions of the state. You can see the colors correspond to the colors on the map. And we modeled six regions. As you can see, about in the baseline case and in the future scenarios, about 60% of the statewide emissions come from the metro region, with Valley contributing about 20%. So there's the bulk right there. Southwest at 7, Northwest 2%, Central at 3.5, and Eastern at 4. The impact of a carbon tax on emissions is similar across regions. We're seeing the similar types of reductions, and you can bring up the other. That'd be great. In here, the size of the pie represents a relative decrease in the total emissions. But what you can see is that basically the pieces of the pie are fairly consistent. We see a small shift out of metro. So metro in the baseline case, that's no carbon tax, runs at 62% roughly right now. And under the $100 per ton, it goes down to 59%. And this is just the concentration of industry and residents in that region. But the change overall is very, very small regionally. We also get information not shown here on economic sector, but it's in the report in section 2 of the results, if you'd like to refer to that. Largest emissions reduction from a carbon tax occur in industrial sectors. Within that, really emission reductions in natural gas and electricity. Residential emissions reductions are second, and within that category, petroleum fuels for transportation is where the largest reductions will occur. Again, I refer you for more information to section 2 of the results. Let's take a look at revenue here. Great revenue. These are the carbon tax scenario revenue projections. The annual tax revenue generated, just calculated by our model, looking using emissions and then the carbon tax rates. And you see two branches emerge here, one for $45 and below, and the other for $60 and above. And that's just because in the $60 and above, we increase the tax at $10 per metric ton per year. Whereas in the lower cases, it's $5 per metric ton per year increase. Overall, just some examples here. At a tax rate of $30 per ton, the revenue stabilizes at about $1.4 billion. This is fairly comparable to the $1.2 billion that BC is getting, though that's Canadian dollars. A tax rate of $60 per ton, revenue stabilizes at $2.4 billion. And at a tax rate of $100 per ton, the revenue stabilizes at $3.5 billion. Approximately within that, about 35% of the revenue comes from the residential sector, and the rest split between industry and commercial sectors. Just want to point out that once the cap is reached, the revenue from, just like emissions, is fairly stable. It's stable within a few percent. Okay, I'll send it back to the left side.
Okay, just very briefly here, just to let you know that, you know, we also used how the Oregon economy looked and helped use that to help calibrate the modeling that we received from the REMI Corporation and going forward, so that it did match up and was very, it is a Oregon-specific modeling that we were doing. Next slide. Just to give you a sense, if we see the baseline here, this baseline is based on a projection that – how the Oregon economy is going to perform and where we think, for example, employment would be out into the horizon out to 2034. And this is the baseline forecast, and it assumes all existing laws stay in place, whether the environmental regulations and so forth. And then we look at two extremes. The first extreme is, what if we would have $100 per CO2 equivalents per ton, and all that money was stuck, as Jeff was describing in scenario A, was just put into a reserve fund and not re-entered into the economy. Or likewise, you think of it as what if this was a federal tax and all the tax money left Oregon and none of it returned? So that's the case that causes the biggest drop in jobs. And that drop in jobs is approximately 35,000, a little bit more than 1% from the baseline. Now, the other part is, what if we had a $30 per ton and all of the money went to the general fund, was spent back in the economy? That has relatively largest positive effect. That's something a little less than 1%. But the main point here is that our analysis going forward and the charts you're going to see are deviations from this baseline. Notice that under any scenario we have here, the baseline and these two scenarios are all positive growth, in the sense that instituting the carbon tax does not cause overall negative growth, but it causes possibly a drag on the growth that we would expect. And with that, we'll turn it over.
So in the interest of time, I'm just going to focus on employment impacts, but I will say that in our report, we go into great detail into output and compensation impacts. So this is a summary of impacts by the scenario types I was mentioning before. You can see that our A scenarios are our extremes, so we have a pretty big range there. What we think are the more realistic scenarios, B is that truly revenue neutral scenario. We see pretty consistently small negative employment impacts. I'll go into more regional detail in a second. C, which is the highway fund, transportation revenues going to the highway fund, plus reductions in personal and corporate income taxes, we generally see small positive impacts. The D scenarios, there's a range of impacts depending on how that revenue is targeted towards specific policy goals. And then our E, our alternative transportation revenue use, it's basically zero. We don't get very far away from the baseline on that one. So we've created a jobs index to make this point a little clearer, and I think there's a full explanation of this in the report, but it's basically jobs impact per $1 million of revenue collected. We put this together, this shouldn't be used to judge how good one scenario is versus the other, but this is just a standardization so we can compare different scenario results. Go ahead. So I'm going to show you two specific scenario results that we think are representative of larger trends. This is the B2 scenario for a range of different carbon prices. So again, this is transportation revenues are used to reduce existing transportation taxes and fees, and then the rest is used to reduce existing tax rates. Generally, in a lot of these scenarios, we see a bump in employment right after the tax is put in place. The reason for this is when this new policy is put in place, industry is going to change its production method, right? So there's an initial push to investment change production to a future that has consistently higher energy prices. We also see in some industries there's a trade-off. So the price of capital relative to the price of labor changes. So some industries change to more labor-intensive production methods. Eventually, what happens in all of these is after the cap is reached, we reach some sort of economic equilibrium. So depending on the phase-in of the tax, that dictates the time it takes us to get to equilibrium. If we go to the next. This is our regional breakdown. The regional breakdown is fairly standard across our scenarios. So generally, we see the Portland metro region having negative economic outcomes. This is due to a couple of reasons. The industry mix in Portland features some industries that are negatively impacted by the tax. Portland is also close to the border with Washington, so we see a little bit more economic leakage across the border. To just reiterate what Tom said, this is still, it's a pretty small percentage of overall Portland employment. Generally, the other regions of the state will be either slightly positive or slightly negative, depending on how the revenues are repatriated or expended. Okay. I'll skip output. We go into great detail. Industry impacts, generally what we see, negatively impacted industries, it's split into two groups. There's the small negative impact, which tends to be energy-intensive industries, so high-tech, advanced manufacturing are consistently negative, but it's usually a very small negative, and in most of the scenarios, it's even double-digit job losses. What's really consistently down at the bottom of the industries affected are service industries. So what's happening here is we've fully incorporated price pass-throughs into our modeling this time. So the service industry tends to be at the end of the supply chain, so there's no one left to pass those prices on to. So they're the ones who are passing on higher prices to consumers, and consumers are buying less of their goods. SB 306, this is discussed in great detail in the report, but SB 306 required us to work with Oregon Business Development Commission to look at a specific set of key industries. Generally, what we find is that outdoor gear and activewear, advanced manufacturing, high-tech, forestry, and wood products, in most scenarios, are slightly negative. Forestry and wood products and outdoor gear and activewear are slightly positive, depending on the scenario. The other two tend to be negative, but again, it's a very small negative. In this case, we pulled out wholesale trade. Wholesale trade is a portion of all four of these key sectors. Wholesale trade is consistently negatively impacted, so rather than hide that within each one of these, we just pulled it out on its own. Clean tech is very strange, and it's due 100% to the definition, right? So the state, us, we just don't have a very good definition of what, specifically what the clean tech sector is here. We have these very broad definitions. So clean tech, there's a lot of overlap with the other industries here. So when we report on clean tech in the report, we're really telling you what's going on in the construction industry or other industries that include small portions of what would be described as clean tech, but it's hard to get a real sense of what's happening here. This will be the last one I show you. So this is looking at employment impacts for a scenario in which the Highway Trust Fund receives the transportation revenues. And what we find here is that the employment results are consistently positive. Basically, what's going on is when the revenue is dedicated to income support, what ends up happening is Oregonians, by and large, will take that extra income. They'll turn it into consumption. Oregonians consume a lot of things that aren't made here in Oregon, so there's economic leakage. If we take some of those, If we take some of those revenues and we dedicate it to what are in effect large public works projects, we keep a lot of that economic benefit here in Oregon, and it's distributed around the state. So that's really the driver of which side of our baseline we end up on. Yes.
Thank you. Yes. Sorry to interrupt, no, but on that slide that showed the negative or positive impacts, I didn't see manufacturing as a category.
Yes, Chair Dembrough, Senator Haas. Manufacturing, it's broken down into a lot of different types of manufacturing activity. In Appendix 2 of the report, you can see more detail on that. But basically, depending on the type of manufacturing, it's either slightly positive or slightly negative. So I'm going to skip the rest here.
All right. So also, we were directed by SB 306 to look at how existing laws here in Oregon interact with the carbon tax. And we have a full analysis of that in the report if you looked in that particular section, which we will not go into in more detail. And this is a table that summarizes some of those effects. And the basic conclusion is that most of these are likely complementary with the carbon tax in that their objectives and goals are inherently different than what the carbon tax might be trying to achieve. And we also discuss further more considerations that we thought through and also further research that would benefit the implementation or understanding of this carbon tax that you can also find in our report.
And so just to wrap up very quickly, with a carbon tax, you can have significant emission reductions and an also revenue-generating potential from having that tax. We said the economic impacts are really small relative to the broader economy, but it is very important to keep in mind that they do differ by the region of the state, by income levels, and by industries. It is possible to offset any negative impacts with targeted expenditures or investments. So very, very broadly, we're looking at the three E's for a tax policy. Is it effective? Does it reach the goal that you want? And thus, whatever carbon price you set should reach whatever reduction goal that you have. And then the second E is it efficient? A price mechanism is very efficient. People do figure out what's the least cost way of reaching the goal. And then is it equitable? Are there ways that we can make this more fair for low-income groups, for targeted industries, either through expenditures or investments for both businesses and households? That finishes our report.
Wow. It's a very extensive report, and colleagues, there is a lot in there. I'm just taking a quick look at it. A lot for us to chew on, and we will be chewing on it. And we don't have time, obviously, to chew on it today. But just a question about next steps. Have you put any thought into what you see as our job going forward with this, the information that you've provided us with?
Yes, Chair Demereaux. Yes, so here we are not in a debate about climate change or anything like that, but it's if you want a method by which to reach carbon reduction goals, we've done a very thorough analysis on if you would use a carbon tax and various scenarios and how, you know. So going forward, thinking about this is there is design. How is it going to be implemented? Is it through existing agencies that you would do it? Other aspects, I think, continuing on is we didn't really look into the possible other costs involved of carbon emissions, be it health, water, you name it, and what would be the benefits of reduction. We just looked at sort of the economic impacts on a private sector basis. Not adding these sort of, reducing the negative externalities to the economy and the advantages of doing that, as examples, I think, of going forward.
Chair Demereaux.
Yes.
Did you study any of the economics of incorporating this tax in our state as compared to what it'll do business-wise to the global community that we have to deal with? How is it going to impact our business cost-wise?
Chair Demereaux, Senator Olson, and I'll have either my colleagues jump in on this. In my mind, there are border effects. And in fact, some of the metro stuff that we looked at and their negative effects was because of the proximity to the state of Washington, so that if they don't have a corresponding tax, they would have certain possible business advantages because of that. We also, in our analysis, think about, you know, if you really were going to do this correctly, anything coming into the state which should be the carbon content of that. We're just at this point looking at the energy aspect and electricity that's produced outside of the state. What carbon content does that have coming into the state? But I really think if we're going to do something about carbon emissions, I really think it's a grassroots approach. I don't think states should be waiting for the federal government to come and make up some policy. I think it's going to be us as first movers, and I think there'll be an advantage to us to being a first mover on this, because this is going to eventually be a global policy that's going to be happening.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for coming and for, I know, staying in touch with us as we have questions.
Yes.
So with that, colleagues, I'm going to close our last meeting of this committee. When this committee meets again, we will probably have new people on it. It's been a pleasure serving with you, and we are adjourned.